On State and Federal Affairs to order Thursday, July 14th, 2005. The amendments for Senate Bill 591 are not ready, so we'll be holding that over. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 300, and we'll open a work session, public hearing and work session. Senator Gordley, Harvey Matthews, Chuck Bennett, and Lori Whalen, if you can get up, can you all get up there, or can you get an extra chair?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Avell Gordley, representing Senate District 23, which is inclusive of wonderful neighborhoods in northeast and southeast Portland. And it is an absolute delight to be before you this morning with my partners who will assist me in laying out what is included in the measure, Senate Bill 300-A, the Expanded Options Program. Senate Bill 300-A creates the Expanded Options Program beginning in the 2006-07 school year. I want to also tell you that the measure before you comes as a result of a lot of hard work and by a lot of wonderful people who participated in a large work group created by my office. And representatives in that work group included the Associated Oregon Industries, the Confederation of School Administrators, the Oregon Community College and Workforce Development, the Oregon Community College Association, the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon University System, and most importantly, parents of students. This bill allows high school juniors and seniors or others eligible to attend an Oregon public high school, and they must be 16 years of age or older, and it allows them to obtain dual high school and college credit if enrolled in eligible community college or Oregon University system courses. It also requires school districts to pay participating students' tuition, fees, and other instructional costs, such as textbooks, equipment, and there is any materials that would be required for qualified post-secondary coursework. And that requirement is outlined in Section 10 of the bill. There is also an exemption for students from liability for these costs, and that's covered in Section 12 of the bill. There's an inclusion for post-secondary academic and professional technical courses and distance education courses, which is outlined in Section 1 of the bill. There is an allowance for post-secondary institutions to retain admission and enrollment requirements for participating students. You'll find that in Section 3 of the bill. And to limit programs accepting students under the program in Section 3 of the bill. There is an exclusion for post-secondary courses that are identical to the scope of another course offered by the student's high school. Section 1 of the bill. There is an allowance that each high school can cap program participation at 330 quarter hours per 1,000 students, which is the equivalent to approximately 7 full-time students per 1,000 enrolled. My partners may want to expand on the cap to aid your fullest possible understanding of how that works. There is direction for schools to give priority for program participation to at-risk students in certain instances. And this is an attempt to also reach students who may have dropped out of their high school, but students who would still have the skills and abilities to participate in a community college or higher ed setting. There's a requirement for school districts to spend for each student in the program a minimum of 50% of the school district's general purpose grant per extended ADMW. That's approximately $2,750 per student. That's outlined in Section 10. And there's a requirement that certain agreements between school districts and post-secondary institutions require certain reporting of program activities. Again, this program will allow both high school students and individuals who've dropped out of high school to enroll in qualified courses in a community college or Oregon University System University and earn dual high school and college credit. Expanded options will help Oregon students obtain the high school and college educations that are so needed in today's economy. Under the Expanded Options Program, students will be able to participate free of charge as they are able to attend high school. The program is funded from state support for K-12 students and is only available to people who have not yet attained a high school degree. Some school districts in this state already pay education costs when their students attend post-secondary institutions. The Expanded Options Program will extend this option to students throughout the state. And again, what we have here, colleagues, is the opportunity to build more of a system in our Oregon education system, more of a system approach, and more access for more students. Oregon's future depends on our ability to improve the educational attainment of its citizens. And to accomplish this, we must work to remove impediments to learning. So again, this is an opportunity that is very much about giving students not only more options, but making them available when the student is ready to move forward, and by providing that financial support so that the student can pursue their education. And it acknowledges that there are students who are better served in a college or university environment. This bill moved out of the Senate with 29 votes. Again, I'm absolutely delighted to be carrying the measure and to be seated here with partners, and there are some seated behind us who have worked so very hard and for a very long time over several sessions and almost 10 years to bring the measure to you. And so with those comments, Mr. Chair, I'll stop talking, and you can hear from my partners, and of course we'll respond to any questions you may have.
Senator Gorley, can you stay with us till they're done when the questions start, or do you need to leave that we need to question you first?
I will stay.
Okay, thank you. Everybody wants to proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I don't have a lot to add to Senator Gordley's outline of the bill. I think more than anything, I'd like to underscore that it's been 10 years working on this bill with many of the folks who I think the senator has been kind enough to acknowledge in opposition. And this is really the session we've been able to all get together, I think, work this bill out. For a variety of reasons, this was a successful opportunity for all of us to take on what has been a program that has been difficult for some groups over the years. I hope you will look at this as the first time you see this bill, for those of you who haven't seen this before, and realize this is going to come back. This is more of a pilot program, and I call your attention to Section 18 of the bill, which outlines the annual report that's going to come back now to the Board of Education and the legislature. And as you have a chance, if you have a chance to go through the kind of information being developed, we're very hopeful this program will begin at this small level with the caps the senator outlined and begin to grow as districts become used to and realize what an opportunity this is to assist at-risk students as well as meet the needs of students that have other needs than just what we're offering at local high schools. And we're just real excited about this program. This is a real opportunity, and we just can't say enough about the spirit that went on around this bill this session. It was a real good experience for all of us. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. My member association wanted to sponsor this and help with this bill because we think it's a very important policy direction to decrease the dropout rate and increase the number of students entering college and trade schools, and also decrease the amount of money that parents are having to pay for their higher education. So those were the major concerns that we had that encouraged us to get into this. This bill was heard in House Bill 2818 in Representative Flores's Education Committee. It was the same exact bill as Senate Bill 300A, and it passed out there unanimously to the Budget Committee. So I feel that the policy angle has been looked at on the House side very thoroughly and thoughtfully. Thank you, Representative Flores. And with that, that's the end of my comments. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen representing the Oregon Education Association. And we were one of those organizations that in the past had concerns about previous iterations of this concept, and we're delighted to be able to work in the work group, which was, as you heard today, one of the most productive experiences any of us have ever had in this building, as we literally hammered out every single sentence and idea in the bill in a way that all of us could agree upon and embrace. And so we are delighted to be able to say that we heartily endorse this bill and hope that you will pass it. Thank you.
Okay. Committee member, do you have any questions or comments on the bill? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for this to the panel, because I know you've been working this over thoroughly and taking it through other committees, but this is my first reading, so I'm just trying to understand the mechanics of it. On the general concept, I want to applaud the work, particularly that Senator Gordley's put in and the rest of you, to make something possible that I think is really going to improve education. I just want to make sure I understand the impact on the flow of dollars, because I see language in the bill in Section 10 that it says a school district shall expend per student participating in the expanded options program a minimum of 50% of the school district's general purpose grant per extended ADWM or ADMW. Now, I think what that's saying is that for each student who is enrolled in the program, that the district gets its regular full ADMW, and that there's an obligation for the district to, in effect, pay over at least half of that than the institution that's providing the education. Am I understanding that correctly? I see some nods, but...
Yes, you are, I think, representative.
Okay, and a follow-up question, if I could. It strikes me that in many situations, students will be enrolling for less than half time. A fairly common scenario is a student who has exhausted all the educational offerings in their high school will want to go to the local community college because there'll be offerings there for just part of the day that might be less than half the day. How does the bill address that situation?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ferson, you went right to the heart of the issue that we probably struggled with the most, and I will tell you that the Oregon Education Association had a very keen eye on the financial aspects of this and have throughout this entire conversation. We felt that this was the very best possible compromise, understanding that in order for this program to be successful, a certain threshold level of dollars needed to be available in order for a school to offer this program. So while there will be some students who might take a course or two, true, there would be others who might actually look to spending the vast majority of their school day on a campus, a community college campus, or even a program on the high school campus. This program doesn't compete with those that may already be offered, such as IB or AP classes, 2+2 programs, or the kinds of arrangements that already exist. It could be an add-on, it could be instead of, or those other programs can exist instead of. But for those who will offer it, we knew that there would be something of a pooling, if you will, of the total credits and the dollars that follow in order for that program to be available to the students who opt for this particular program.
And to add to that, if
yeah,
I may, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, and good morning to you. Again, placing the emphasis on providing additional options that allow students to complete their education, recognizing that we want students to have what we're calling concurrent opportunities to do their high school work, but also earn college credits, which can also mean gaining early entry into post-secondary education.
I just have a mechanical question, though. What happens to the in the situation where a student is otherwise enrolled full-time in the high school, and there's just one class, say they've exhausted the science series that's available in their high school, and they want to take a physics course that's available at the community college that isn't available in their school, and so they go over for just one class a day. Would that situation fit within this program?
Absolutely, yes.
But what about the requirement that 50% be expended, because the tuition for that one class wouldn't be 50% of an ADMW.
Representative McPherson, I think staff has some information.
Mr. Chair, that was my question to them yesterday because that was confusing to me. It's an average of 50%, so each student
average.
Doesn't get 50, need to get 50%. So if they spend less, every student that comes under the cap will get either the full amount, they'll get the full amount that they need. If they go full time, they'll get full time. If they go for one course, they'll get paid for the cost of that one course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the answer. Thank you very much.
Okay. Reverend Flores.
Thank you, esteemed panel. A question for you, and I'm very supportive of the opportunities that are provided here for students to make that dual program work for them. I did have email, and I would like you to address this so we can have it on the public record, from some educators basically saying, what are you doing? They are concerned that the at-risk population students and those that have dropped out could arbitrarily drop out and still be guaranteed a free education at the higher level. So I'd just kind of like you to cover that ground for us a little bit so that we can have people with some clarity on what is being accomplished here.
Do you want to speak to how the work group
yes.
had that discussion?
Yes. Chair Krieger, Representative Flores. What we determined there in that instance was that our goal was to recapture as many dropouts as possible. And the best way that we found to do that was to make sure those students were got readmitted in order to take advantage of this program. They have to be readmitted into their school district, and then, and only then, would they be able to engage in the expanded options program. There are still a couple of filters, if you will, to make sure that a student that is not prepared for these continuing expanded options doesn't waste taxpayer money in that endeavor, and that is that the approved post-secondary institutions have to accept them and have to deem them emotionally and educationally mature enough to take full advantage of that opportunity. So I hope that answers the question.
Follow up. So in that re-enrollment process, is there testing done to determine their academic level, or is it just an automatic re-enrollment by virtue of them signing in with the district?
Well, Representative Flores, I think the testing question would be a function of their admission to the post-secondary school they're attending. The thing that I think is striking about the comments you received is that if that's one of the worst criticisms of the bill is, my gosh, you're getting dropouts into school, we would like to we subscribe. If that's the problem they're trying to describe, these students will have to maintain, they have to get in, they have to maintain a level of success that continues their admission to the school and education, so they'll be meeting all the hurdles that any other student would have to meet in this case, and particularly in the case of these students, whether they're at risk or other students, is they're advancing their education, they're developing both for their high school diploma, they're developing a relationship with a higher education institution, and hopefully going to continue their education beyond this program. It creates that relationship for them and that experience. I think that often folks worry about change just because it's change. And in this case, I think it is a change that has enough safeguards built into the bill that we're going to know if there is some sort of anomaly that develops around that kind of problem. But this is, I think we've caught all the issues.
I would like to ask, I just saw John Marshall, Mr. Marshall, Oregon School Boards Association, with the chair's permission, if he would like to contribute to this conversation and your understanding. The Oregon School Boards Association made a significant contribution to the measure before you, and I just think it's important that they have words on the record as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. In response to Representative Flores' question, I would point out in the bill on page 2, describes an eligible student, that is a student that's eligible to participate in the program, and it requires that the student to be enrolled in an Oregon public school. So that means that a student that's dropped out, we've all of a sudden got an incentive for them to re-enroll because they can now be eligible for this program and begin to earn concurrent credit at a post-secondary institution while they're still in high school. And secondly, it requires another definition, or an added definition to eligible student, is they have to develop an education learning plan. And that means they sit down with the high school, the counselor, their parents, and determine if the student is in fact ready for college level work while they're still in high school, a discussion about what their next steps may be after high school. So there is a conversation with the high school to determine if this student's ready, to make sure the student understands it's going to be a higher level of work and make sure that they are in fact ready to move on. So those were some of the conditions that with which we were concerned, to make sure that this is not just an opportunity for students to get a free ride at the school district's expense, but was in fact focused on the students' abilities and their willingness to accept the level of work beyond high school or while they're still in high school. So those were one of the many protections that we think that we've added to the bill to assure that there's that discussion.
Mr. Chair, if you'll permit me to add on one last thing. And one other point that we think is pretty important is when a student has not been present in school for, I think it's 10 days, the district is required to send out a letter to ascertain whether or not that student has dropped out. And under Senate Bill 300, we have added the notification about this program, recognizing that there are different reasons students leave school. And for those who simply don't feel they're adequately challenged or need to move on, they will then know that this program exists. We hope that means that they won't then drop out. They'll stay enrolled until they can become eligible and participate in this program as an alternative to dropping out.
Excuse me, follow-up question. Thank you. I hope you understand we're messaging here for some of the criticisms that I sense from what I have already heard might be coming, so I'm trying to undergird the discussion here. Do you have any information about the extent of the dropout rate prior to 12th grade? In other words, senior year of high school.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I think they're John Marshall, by the way. I believe there's ample data regarding the extent to which students drop out before completing high school. And it's difficult. It depends on how you define a dropout. But I think any of us in that work in public education would suggest that it's too high, whatever the number is and however it's determined. And is there a way to create more relevance for a student while they're in high school? And we approach this that there are precedents currently existing in Oregon statute for school districts to spend dollars to serve students with particular needs. For example, if we're going to expel a student, we have to offer them an alternative program. And that alternative program could be in some kind of a public or private placement. And we're required to spend 80% of our resources to provide the program for that student. Charter schools, where if a student wants to go to a charter school, where some of the school district's dollars are required to follow that student to the tune of 80 or 90% of the student's general purpose grant. Students with disabilities, if they require some kind of special program, federal law requires us to provide that program for them. So we view this as a way to allocate resources to serve students that are currently not being served, first, and second, that are ready to prepare for a future while they're still in high school. And that can include classes in a four-year institution or some kind of applied science or math classes that may lead to an associate degree at a community college. So we think this is going to create much more relevance for students while they're still in high school, make them understand that they can begin to get some post-secondary work while they're still in high school. There are going to be resources there to help them, and we think this is going to get to a lot of those students that are questioning, you know, here I am in high school, I want to be an auto mechanic, why do I have to sit through this world history class? And if they can understand that there's some relevance to what they're doing and what they want to do post-high school, I think it's a valuable approach.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, if I may add, while I do not have the current dropout numbers in front of me, I do recall that just within the past few weeks, we received a report from the Department of Education which reveals that after a period of decline in the dropout rate, we're now seeing an upturn. So that should give us, that should be a cause of alarm for all of us. And I think if we look at this as a public policy contribution to creating or further creating a seamless educational system in the state of Oregon, that's a part of what this is about. Having a seamless educational system that again addresses the student's need and desire to move on when that student is ready and able to move on, wherever that student is, in school, out of school. And so this is good public policy and coming at a really good time in the state of Oregon.
One further comment, I think.
Okay,
thank you. And I would suggest that perhaps this is maybe a beginning point of the conversation that I know that is percolating in some components of the education field in regard to questioning maybe the relevance of that 12th year for students who are not being challenged in their senior year of high school. So might be a nice path here.
Mr. Chair, may I add one additional point for the record? I want to acknowledge Representative Dahlem. I don't believe he was able to be present today. I think he may be in his district. But he has worked long and hard over the course of the session on this measure as well. And I know that if he could be here, he would want to be seated right here expressing his support for the bill. In fact, I've encouraged him to sign on as a co-sponsor. So again, I just want to acknowledge his hard work and his contribution to the measure before you.
Okay. Committee members, have any other further questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 300 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 300 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative
Bolton. Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Seeger.
All right. Senate Bill 300 moves to the floor with a due pass, and Representative Dahlem will be the carrier.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator. We're going to move on to Senate Bill 815, open a public hearing and work session. And then we'll be going back after that to Senate Bill 765 at the top of the agenda.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 815 comes to you sponsored by Senator George at the request of the Foster Parents Association. This is a bill that does two things. It first specifies a bill of rights for foster parents. That is included in Section 2. It includes such things as foster parents have the right to be treated with respect and dignity, be included as a valued member of the team for planning of a foster child, receive certain support resources from DHS, and other rights. And then Section 2 of the bill makes an amendment to the statute that permits certain parties to intervene in juvenile dependency cases. This was the subject of another bill that we heard some time ago. The tweak is to the definition of caregiver for purposes of the intervener statute. Currently, the law says that the relationship between the person and the child has to be more than 12 months, and this bill would amend it to 6 months, so it would shorten the time under which a person could be considered a caregiver for purposes of intervening in a juvenile dependency case. There are no amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. Senator George, please. And let's have Terry Fennell and Kevin George come up maybe together. It takes up three of the chairs.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. And I'm pleased to bring you a bill today that I think not only will we all walk away from this session feeling good about, but actually knowing that we have done some tremendous good. We provided today an article in the New York Times talking about the scourge of drugs and what that's done. And, of course, they actually quoted here Oregon and the number of children that are coming into our foster care system beyond what we ever anticipated. Now, last year, I want to back up to a period of time in which we had hearings, informal hearings, in which we heard from foster parents and those in the child care system. And what we heard from them was is that we really, as a state and as an agency, didn't seem to provide the support, the training, recognition of how valuable a partner foster parents are. So we came up with the idea of adopting a statement, a bill of rights, similar to what other states have done. And you see a modified version of that before you today. We were asked to back out certain issues, which we did. but I believe it's a bill that provides a statement of clarity relative to how we as the state of Oregon are going to treat those folks who provide loving care for our foster children. As you saw in that article, the idea of providing quality care is critical for the success or failure of those children. And too many examples and too much research indicating that if, in fact, we don't deal with those children, we'll get to deal with them later in the criminal system. It's critical that we show the kind of support we should for the foster parents. And I hope you'll look favorably upon this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Whoever who wants to be next.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm policy advisor for Senator George. A couple of clarifications on more reason for this. When we started hearings last in the interim, we were looking at ways to increase the number of foster parents, and it became obvious from interviewing foster parents at those hearings that the problem was much larger than we anticipated, in that foster parents had become disenfranchised from the system, and they themselves were not eager to help in recruitment efforts in what they saw as being a dysfunctional system. So this is an important bill in terms of starting the process of straightening out the relationship between foster parents and the state and getting things moving to where we can recruit more foster parents, and we need them desperately. The number of counties are short right now, and the growing meth problem indicates we're going to have a bigger bulge coming. Secondly, the original bill had a provision in it that made the foster parent a full participant in court proceedings regarding the foster child, as would be the case of the CASA, the attorney for the child and the caseworker. We abandoned that because it had an enormous fiscal attached to it, and this did not seem to be the session that we wanted to introduce a bill with a lot of money attached to it. So we backed that out and instead changed, with the assistance of our legal team, changed the provision to simply moving intervener status up for 6 months. The reason for that provision, as you stated earlier, intervener status can be applied for at 12 months under existing statute. Under the later federal regulations, the disposition of a case, permanency planning for a child has to be completed or well on its way by 12 to 14 months. So 12 months is simply too late for a foster parent to be a realistic intervener on behalf of a child. So we moved that back to 6 months, figuring that if you had someone living in your home for 6 months on a daily basis, you've got a pretty good idea what's going on there, and that should qualify you to be an intervener on behalf of that child. And we think that's a good change to, again, give the foster parents a little more empowerment in the disposition of some of these cases. Beyond that, this is a very simple bill. I don't see any additional problems in it. I would also say it's at the foundation. There's a lot of work to be done yet. One of the issues that is not addressed in this is a formal grievance procedure for foster parents who are at odds with their caseworker, and that happens quite often. That is not in this bill, but we've been assured, talking with people at DHS, that we can handle that by administrative rule, and they're equally concerned about those provisions. So this is the foundation. You'll probably see more requests next session for additional changes, but it's a place we need to start.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Terry Fennell. I live here in Marion County. I have been a foster parent for 20 years. Had over 700 teenagers live in my home, and I currently serve on the legislative committees for the state, local, and national level, chairing the state level and our local level here in Marion Polk County. And I feel that this bill really needs to be pressed forward because of as was stated, the recruitment and retention is essential for foster parents. I just this week had a potential foster parent call me and ask me what I thought about becoming a foster parent, and it was difficult for me to, under current circumstances, to just recommend that they should just sign on up. It's difficult when we have to face some of the issues that we currently do, and we have to legislate respect and trust and so on. And I'm sorry that we have to do that, but I feel that that would be very important as a first step towards for foster parents to be able to assist in the recruitment process and to retain foster parents now that are concerned with the interactions sometimes that they have with some of the workers. We have many people, many foster parents have expressed an interest in having this passed, and we have made several adjustments along the way, and I think that we now have a bill that really represents what foster parents in Oregon feel is a good first step. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 815B, as written. But I would like to point out two areas that I've noted in my written testimony for consideration. And one being, as Mr. Thompson had noted, was that we had made a commitment with the Oregon Foster Parent Association that there needs to be a clarification of our grievance procedure for foster parents so they actually can voice their concerns in a very linear, consistent process throughout the state. There are currently administrative rules around that, but they are conflicting in some areas, and so it's a matter of going back and recrafting those into a very succinct process so all foster parents, no matter if you live in Baker County, Coos County, or Portland, have the same rights and role responsibilities. The other piece that I would bring to your attention is the Section 2 amendment. Section 2 in this bill, and just give you a point of history is that 10, 15 years ago, the intervener status for foster parents was about 36 months. The legislature made the decision down to 18 months and then it down to 12, and so now the request is moving it down to 6 months. I think there's a difference in that historically there's always been a step difference between a relative being able to apply for intervener status and a foster parent. This new provision actually moves the foster parent to be in line with a relative, so a grandmother who may also be seeking intervener status at the same time, to both having a six-month window of time before they can actually file a motion for intervener status. So beyond that, I appreciate the fact that the committee is willing to listen to the needs of foster parents and improving the system for foster care, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have as well.
Okay, committee members, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Kevin George. I need a little bit more sort of orientation on what the issues are resolved in juvenile dependency proceedings and what it means to be an intervener.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson. For juvenile matters, these children are coming before the juvenile court as a result of child abuse or neglect. There's a legal petition that's been filed to say parents have not been caring for this child, and here are the allegations. And then they are proven or disproven at that point in time. A legal party to the case is that the juvenile court will have assigned an attorney for the child. They'll assign an attorney for the parents. The Department of Human Services goes in as the caseworker to represent the departments, and sometimes you'll have a district attorney there at the very beginning of a case. The legal party status then provides you the opportunity to ask for hearings, to actively participate in hearings where you can actually call witnesses and file motions and receive all the court documents. The intervener status then also allows someone to, on the tail end of that, become and request visitation of the child, allows the intervener to request for permanent placement of the child at the point in time where a decision needs to be made around permanency for a child. And so it may be that an intervener can actually step forward or has the right to step forward and say, I would like to be considered as a permanent placement for the child. So that's the difference that currently foster parents have to wait that 12 months versus the 6 months which is being proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We had another bill that had to do with adopting, and we took the caregivers out of that and just have grandparents first and then blood relatives. And one of the reasons they said one of the reasons came up in discussions about removing the foster parent from that was that, gee, they're only going to have to be there 6 months, and it wouldn't give them priority over the grandparents, but just with them. But anyway, they've been taken off. I just wondered if you think that will affect foster parenting at all, that the fact that they're no longer
on that list. I ask anybody, I just throw it out there.
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker. Yes, I actually had paid attention to that bill, and it was interesting to note the similarities, and that was part of the struggle we had earlier in this session around bills that had competing interests. There is a strong advocacy from relatives to say, wait a sec, we want first of our children. And it is the department's position, and has always been the department's position, that we look at relatives and relatives first, and there are other statutes that do support that. The intervener status, I do not believe, would prohibit a relative still from being first sought after, but it does move the foster parent's rights to ask for that earlier into a case. I think it's relevant from the standpoint that over time the child welfare laws have changed fairly dramatically to where, as noted earlier, we are to be making a decision within 12 to 14 months where this child's going to grow up. And so from that reason alone, it's important for foster parents to get a voice earlier in the system, because it may be that the train has already left the station by the time they can stand forward.
Okay, thank you. Any further?
No.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We have Joyce Padilla and Ruth Johnson, please.
Chairman Krieger and the committee, for the record, my name is Joyce Padilla, and I am a foster parent, and I work as a foster parent in Marion and Polk County both. And I'm here just to say you have my written testimony before you, and I'd like to say that I do support this bill and the amendments, and would like to ask you to support that with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Good morning. My name is Ruth Johnson, and I too am a Marion and Polk County foster parent, and I have been for almost 6 years now. And during that 6 years, I have had 15 foster children. 11 of those foster children have been either adopted or placed in permanent care, and only 4 were successfully returned home. Of those children, 11 of those children were removed from the home due to excessive drug use in the home. And of those children, 9 were adopted, and I just Tuesday successfully adopted 5 of my foster children, a sibling group, who were removed from their home due to drug use. And I just want to voice that this bill is really needed for foster parents, because it was an uphill battle to adopt these children due to the fact that we were foster placement, and they discourage foster parents to adopt. So I just wanted to thank you for hearing our bill. Thank you.
Have any questions, committee members? Okay, thank you very much. As a note, I recognize that someone had 700 foster children over the years, and I kind of wonder how anyone could do that. I had 12, and that was enough. And one of them, Jeff, we got him when he's 9. He's 40 now. He came home at Christmas, walked through the door, says, "Hello, Dad," and walked to the refrigerator, opened it. That's what I always used to get after him about. Every time, you know, in the house, in the door, in the refrigerator. I said, "Well, things haven't changed in 31 years.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 815B to the floor.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 815B to the floor with a due pass. Any objections, questions? Call the roll.
Representative
Parker. Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Krieger.
Aye. Senate Bill 815B moves the floor to do pass. Representative McPherson, would you carry?
Be pleased to, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to hand you the gavel for starting on. Close the work session. I'm going to be leaving you for a while to meet with the Speaker, and Representative Boquist is going to hold some public hearings.
We're going to open a work session on SB 765. Jim, would you bring us up to speed?
Yes, sir. This is a rather lengthy summary, so please bear with me. Senate Bill 765A requires the State Board of Education to designate Education Service Districts, ESDs, as Regional Education Service Agencies, RESAs, setting goals for RESAs and criteria for an ESD to become an RESA. Requires the State Board of Education to designate qualified ESDs as RESAs by March 31st, 2006. Requires the Superintendent of Public Instruction to present to school districts prior to March 31st, 2006, three or more models for the organizational structure of ESDs, one based on the current structure, one based on ESDs as RESAs, and a variation on those two. Requires school districts to prioritize the list of choices. Requires the superintendent to recommend to the board before March 31st, 2006, the model to apply to each ESD, ESD mergers or divisions, designations of ESDs as RESAs, and ESD boundaries. By March 31st, 2006, requires the State Board of Education to merge or divide existing ESDs based on the plan adopted. Makes order effective on July 1st, 2007. Allows the new ESD board to take action while in transition. Requires the State Board of Education to adopt criteria for local service plans to be adopted by the ESD budget committees and criteria for entrepreneurial services. Clarifies that ESDs are to be liaisons between the Department of Education and school districts to facilitate and support the efforts of school districts to meet requirements of state and federal law. Directs the ESD to work with ODE to analyze data and identify areas that need improvement. States core services that are to be delivered by ESD to their component school districts. Requires annual performance measures for ESDs. Requires local service plans to be approved by the ESD budget committee, adopted by the ESD board, and then approved by two-thirds of the component school districts. Requires at least 90% of money received by the ESD through the equalization formula to be spent on services required by the local service plan. Allows an ESD to provide entrepreneurial services to public and private entities or other school districts under specified circumstances. Requires an annual financial report to the budget committee and ESD board. Establishes a 9-member ESD board, including 5 directors, each representing the ESD zone, elected by the component school districts, boards and 4 directors appointed by the other 5, representing higher education, social services, the business community, and an at-large position. Sets staggered terms of office for new ESD board members. Addresses vacancies on the ESD board. Deletes geographic definitions of existing ESDs, divides ESDs into 5 zones to be as equal in population as possible, and requires each zone to elect a representative to the ESD board. Requires merged ESDs to divide themselves into 5 zones, clarifies the power of the new board prior to existence of the new district, addresses labor issues in ESDs, sets an operative date of July 1st, 2007, and effective date of July 1st, 2005. It has a subsequent referral to the budget committee. I've attached the Senate vote, the fiscal analysis, and the revenue impact statement, and we have 1 amendment so far.
Can you explain the dash 5 at all?
The dash 5 will remove the component school districts within the education service district with a population of 25,000 or less that serve an area of 3,000 square miles or more. This is primarily for the frontier ESDs.
Okay, thank you. For Eastern Oregon?
Yes.
Eastern Oregon. Questions, the administrator, before we proceed? Seeing none, we've accomplished 2 bills in an hour, so we'll try and tighten up the schedule here and be as brief as possible, but succinct. The first panel is Ozzie Tricia Smith and Rob Myers. Representative Smith, why don't you come up too?
Well, I'd like to be. They're the brains behind this.
Well, then let's get them up here. Who do you want to come up with?
Oh, I'm just teasing.
Okay.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. Colleagues, I've introduced amendments to Senate Bill 765 for one reason, and that is the geographical distance separating our school districts and our ESDs is tremendous. Let me put this into perspective for you. I live in Heppner, Oregon. In order for me to get to the state capitol from Heppner, Oregon, it takes me 3 hours and 55 minutes. For me to get to Troy, Oregon, which is in my district, from Heppner, Oregon, takes me about 4 hours and 20 minutes. For me to get to Emnaha in my district from Heppner, Oregon, takes about 4 hours. The concern I have with a consolidation of our smallest DSDs is that they're not going to get the service delivery that they so desperately need and deserve, particularly when you take into consideration that there's a geographical barrier in mountains that during the winter have significant snowpack and make travel overpasses very, very difficult. There's a reason we have passes called Dead Man's Pass. There's a reason we have canyons called Hell's Canyon. And I hope you'll take those thoughts into consideration. Now, with that said, I also have the not-so-favorable advantage of representing an ESD that's known as the Union Baker ESD. And as you folks know, the Union Baker ESD has had many, many terrible difficulties before it where administrators made very, very poor decisions. And as a result of that, it's created some outcry from my area wanting tighter regulation, tighter control, and tighter oversight. And I truly respect that. I'm not sure this bill gets to that. I'm not sure if what we're doing is just creating larger ESDs. But I'm not an expert on ESD management. What I would ask is that you be sympathetic to the smallest of ESDs. Understand that our small five frontier ESDs are operating very well, very efficiently. They're very well respected. There's tremendous community input in their management, and they're providing a valuable service to our most needy children. Now, let me tell you why I know that. I have a child who receives services from our ESD. I have a child who has a high IQ but has dyslexia and has difficulty reading and writing. I can share with you firsthand our ESDs have provided tremendous service to my son. Tremendous service. I can do nothing but give them a huge thumbs up. I also have another son who has a high IQ, gets it from his mother, who is a TAG student and has also received very, very exceptional service from the ESD in terms of extracurricular activities to enhance the learning environment that he needs. So I can share with you that ESDs do work. From a parent's perspective, I do not understand the management. I don't proclaim to share with you I understand the management of them. I guess that's a responsibility for this committee. But what I would ask you to do is to remember there are parents out there that support our ESDs, and I'm not sure that consolidating ESDs in making them larger is necessarily more efficient. So I would ask at a bare minimum that you would adopt the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 765, the dash 85s. And I guess with that, I'd say thank you for your time.
Questions of Representative Smith? Thank you.
Thank
Delighted
you.
To have you here. Now we'll go back. Ozzie, Tricia Smith, and Rob Myers. And I guess we'll start on my left, your right.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose. I'm not Ozzie Tricia Smith, in the case anybody got confused.
Neither am I.
I'm representing the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts, and I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 765A and the amendments that have just been offered to you. There is a need for strong regional service network to effectively and efficiently deliver the assets required to provide every child in Oregon a quality education. Let that be very clear. The issue is not new. The issue of how many there should be is not new. The restructuring of the ESDs as an issue has been before this body 9 times in the last 4 decades, as often as we voted on a sales tax, by the way. And it always, every time you talk about restructuring the ESDs for good reason, the debate always in this building deteriorates to the boundaries which exist and which don't exist. And in fact, the bill before you now doesn't merge any ESDs. But the discussions about merging ESDs, the bill, the original bill 765 provided for merging ESDs. 765 as amended instructs the department to create, and this is going on across the nation by the way, larger, combines existing ESDs, not in terms of their governance and so forth, but in terms of developing a distribution network to get services and support to every kid in Oregon. But the debate, again, has deteriorated to the existence or non-existence of existing ESDs. We believe it's too late in the session to make those kinds of decisions. Your substitute committee had this issue before them early in the session, debated it, and dropped it. They had almost the identical bill to 765 as it was first introduced, amended it, and sent out a statement about entrepreneurial activities and dropped the issue. And we would encourage you to drop the issue now rather than make some small tweaks that end up, that get in the way of what we really need to establish, and that is a strong regional network to support schools who are under great pressure to make every kid successful. And they need strong regional support to do certain things. And we would encourage you to take a deep breath, let this go by this time, and see where we are when we come back 2 years from now. The issue of dropping out, I think it's about 5 or 6 would be dropped out if you add these amendments. And I only use that to, I don't know, it's a good idea or not a bad idea. I'm going to debate that part. But to come at this moment and say that's the issue, that's not the issue. The issue is an effective and efficient network that gets services to kids. And I would encourage you to not at this late date move this. You're not going to debate it and pay very much attention to it, given the other things on your plate. And I hope I haven't offended anybody with that line of thought. But that's where we are. It's the middle of July. And I would encourage you to put the bill aside and come back another crack at it after the interim. And I suspect it will be an issue during the interim committee. At any rate, we would oppose the bill. And we would oppose the amendments that have been offered. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Rob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I live in Condon, and I'm here representing the 5 Frontier Rural ESDs, which are North Central, Grant, Harney, Lake, and Wallowa. First, I'd like to make it very clear that the only reason I wasn't able to fill this room completely with county judges, commissioners, local school board members, ESD board directors, and mayors, and other elected officials from the 7 counties affected by this legislation is because we just found notification of it 22 hours ago, and it takes anywhere from 8 to 16 hours round trip to get here. If they were here, I assure you that they would be testifying unequivocally in opposition to Senate Bill 765 because it provably reduces the quality and the quantity of educational services that would be delivered to frontier rural students, and it would cause irreparable economic harm to the sustainability of local and community rural economies. I'd also like to reiterate the very awkward position that this legislation places Representative Smith in, and it's another example of the potential consequences that the legislation does not anticipate. I want to relate a couple of quick facts that have to do with the uniqueness of delivering services in remote rural Oregon and the area of the frontier rural ESDs. They serve 5,644 students spread across 30,000 square miles. If you took every man, woman, and child in that 30,000 square miles and put them in either Reese or Austin stadiums, there'd still be 25,000 empty seats. There are 17,000 more students K-12 in the Beaverton Hillsboro school districts than there are people in the service area of the five Frontier Rural ESDs. Three of the five Frontier Rural ESDs actually return money to the state due to the differential between the funding floor that they receive and the tax revenues they generate. This bill proposes sweeping changes in organization and structure of ESDs with little or no regard for the very real differences in the way ESDs necessarily operate. It's a bill that supposedly solves the ESD, quote, problem, unquote, without first identifying what that problem is or whether or not such a problem really exists. To suggest, as this bill does, that it represents a reasonable process through which an equitable solution can be implemented completely ignores the glaring fact that no specific problem requiring such a solution has been articulated clearly or otherwise. I can further state without equivocation that the Frontier ESDs are not a part of whatever problem might exist. Collectively, they represent a mere 2.7% of the overall state school fund allocation to education service districts. Their revenues constitute only 3.9% of the revenues generated by the largest six ESDs in the Northern Willamette Valley. And that doesn't include the tens of millions of dollars those ESDs generate in contract revenues outside the formula. Now, that doesn't mean, and it shouldn't mean, that the Frontier ESDs would not be willing participants in a positive and constructive process to provide better educational opportunities for all of Oregon students. Between them, they provide high-quality educational services to those 5,600 students spread across that same 30,000 square miles, and nobody does it, quite frankly, more effectively or efficiently than the Frontier Rural ESDs. That doesn't mean, however, that they do not constantly strive to improve the manner in which they deliver those services and the effectiveness and the efficacious thereof. For example, 2 years ago, they formed by intergovernmental agreement an ORS 190 entity that was designed to take full advantage of the aggregated resource model that is the functional equivalent of urban economies of scale. We should constantly be looking for better, more effective, and efficient ways to deliver educational services. We, in fact, have a solemn obligation to the children of Oregon to do just that. But 765 does not represent a methodology for any such effort. It is a fatally flawed legislation that will not produce any demonstrable savings or efficiencies, and it will probably reduce the quality and quality of services to Frontier Rural students. I would respectfully suggest that there is a better way to approach the betterment of ESD operations in Oregon, and the five Frontier Rural ESDs would be willing participants in such a process. First, however, we must survive the third attempt in the last four sessions to eliminate us. So while we oppose this bill in its present form and in its entirety, if for some reason this body deems it worthy of passage, I would implore you to do so only with the -5 amendment that would allow the Frontier ESDs to remain intact and to continue serving the districts and the students to whom they are obligated and the communities of which they are such integral parts. Thank you.
Thank you. Tricia?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents classified and certified education professionals and ESDs all over Oregon. And I'm here today to offer our concerns regarding Senate Bill 765A as it's written. ESDs exist in Oregon to provide a critical function that school districts themselves found that they could not provide individually. Because of the unique makeup of our state and our education system, these important functions are still important and should be protected in order to make sure that students all over Oregon have access to a quality education. It's clear from recent events in ESDs that ESDs have too much authority to engage in entrepreneurial activities unrelated to the provision of services to their students, have little understanding of public contracting and public disclosure laws, and seem to take pains to shut the public out of their decision-making processes, present company excepted, of course. OSEA supports legislation such as House Bill 3184, which came out of the Education Committee and passed this chamber, that addresses gaps in ESD governance and accountability statutes that have allowed ESDs to make imprudent fiscal decisions contrary to the best interests of students, taxpayers, and the public. However, we do not support legislation that will weaken the ability of ESDs to perform the important functions that best serve students. Unfortunately, it appears to us that Senate Bill 765 does little to improve the problems of ESDs, focusing instead on a process for consolidation of ESDs and a new governance structure of the succeeding education service agencies that focuses them away from services to students and eliminates the public input that ESDs are lacking even more so now. Merely making ESDs bigger will not cause them to operate more appropriately or more efficiently, nor will these goals be achieved by eliminating public participation in the ESD process, as Senate Bill 765 does. Sections 2 and 9 of the bill add a new requirement to the mission of ESDs to be that of a go-between between the Department of Education and school districts. This change does nothing to refocus ESDs back to their original and still important mission of providing the structure of cooperative provision of education services to students within the service area. Rather, their mission will be muddied as they must now serve two masters, the Department of Education and the local school districts. Section 2 also puts in place a requirement that will require consolidation of the smaller ESDs. As you've heard from my partners here at the witness table, there are definite problems in creating that scenario. ESDs also under Section 2 must have additional expertise and capacity to, among other things, demonstrate knowledge of public contracting laws and best business practices, have significant audit experience and ability, have sufficient numbers of employees to provide accounting services to component school districts, and to provide oversight of school district fiscal practices. The bill requires they have this knowledge and ability, whether or not school districts require it of them. OSEA does not support the concept of consolidation of ESDs unless there's an identified specific operational improvement in education services to students in the districts served by the ESD. These provisions do not provide that. Section 2 also requires that for ESDs to continue as education service agencies, they must be able to demonstrate a host of other vague attributes unrelated to direct services to students, such as leadership in the improvement of the public school system, ability to collect, organize, synthesize, and evaluate data relating to student achievement and school finance, providing training for implementation of state and federal law, and data collection and analysis, and the list goes on and on. Ability to provide services to students is finally mentioned as the last requirement in Section 2. We believe it should be the first. The amendment does not eliminate the ability of ESDs to develop entrepreneurial services, instead adding new restrictions on the activity. Serious problems of fiscal management have arisen from ESDs pursuing these types of activities, and rather than focusing on provision of education services to students, developing business plans that allow ESDs to compete with private businesses or to look beyond their own geographic area to provide services to districts served by other ESDs paves the way for mismanagement of educational funds and duplication of services. ESDs should be refocused onto the provision of educational services to students within their service area. Finally, the amendment sets up a new governance structure for successor education service agencies that removes the public even further from the ESD's decision-making process. With more than $500 million of taxpayer money going to ESDs, and given the poor track record of ESDs and school districts in making sound fiscal decisions, providing more public oversight rather than less seems the prudent course of action. Section 14 replaces the budget committee, currently made up of elected board members of the ESD and component school districts, with school superintendents from component districts. No information has been provided the committee to indicate how this would improve ESD decision-making processes. Given that the amendment also requires ESDs to conduct performance and fiscal audits of component school districts, it seems a conflict of interest to us to have the superintendent subject to such audits setting the budget and programs for the ESD. Section 21 replaces the current elected ESD Board of Directors with a board consisting of 5 members elected to the boards of the component school districts and 4 others appointed by the first 5. A board seat is not provided for a parent or a member of the general public. Again, the amendment seems contradictory to its goals by first requiring ESDs to act as watchdogs of component school districts, fiscal and management practices, but then putting component school districts in charge of ESD policy, program, and budget. We can think of no other government entity at the local level having so much taxpayer revenue at its disposal that does not have directors elected by the public. In summary, Senate Bill 765 overshoots the mark of improving ESD accountability and providing assurance that ESDs focus on the provision of educational services to students in component school districts in cooperation with those districts. Passing 765 in its current form will only serve to make the situation worse rather than better, in our opinion, while wasting large amounts of time and scarce dollars in planning and implementation. We encourage the committee to narrowly focus on the problems that have arisen in ESDs by requiring more public access to decision-making and prohibiting entrepreneurial activities not consistent with providing educational services to students within the district. These changes provide positive improvement to ESDs without creating a new set of problems. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions to the panel? Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair? Could I
use
the least amount of time, so could I have a second?
Are you begging?
I just want to clarify that I am against the bill, but that does not mean I concur with all the testimony of my colleagues.
Well, everybody wants to quantify, right?
Okay.
Go ahead. Questions? I do have just one process where this passed the Senate 24-3. It went through the Education Committee, the Revenue Committee, and the Budget Education Subcommittee. I'm assuming the three of you testified at all three of those committees also?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay.
I did not testify at all three of those committees. I was not invited to do so. I did present testimony very similar to that which I have provided you.
Okay. Thank you. There's no questions. We'll move on to Julie Suonic and James Sayer. What? Sager. I apologize.
Okay.
You're on the governor's staff. What can I say?
That okay.
Just so you know, we're neutral to supportive, so that's why we got the two. But you're at opposite ends. We do realize that.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Julie.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Julie Sahonik. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association, which represents Oregon's 17 community colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians. And we have actually a technical change that we'd like to see amended on the bill. If you could turn your attention to page 2, sections or lines 36 and 37. We believe in talking with Vicki Fleming with the Oregon Department of Education and also working with our own agency, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, that this was an oversight and that we were mistakenly added into that line. We would like to have the phrase "and community colleges," which is specifically on line 36, removed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Sager from the governor's office. I'd just like to take a few moments to speak in favor of Senate Bill 765 as it comes to you. Senator Walker put together a work committee that we participated in along with the department and representatives from ESDs and school districts. And we tried to take a bill that initially started off with a kind of a clear-cut mission, reduce the number of ESDs, come up with a new map. And we took that idea and said, we've got to put that aside and really look at what the needs of the system are. What are the needs from the standpoint of the Department of Education in helping to deliver support and services out into the regions of the state and the 198 school districts and the children that they provide service to. The coordination between the department and these school districts. We tried to address concerns that had been brought to the work group from school districts that felt that they were not listened to in the current process, that their input wasn't reflected in the programs that the ESDs or some ESDs were providing. We also tried to look at the fact that there are geographic issues, but there are also technology issues that exist today where we don't have to have the ability to physically drive from point A to point B every day, but in fact we can use technology and provide the services. So with that work and the work that the Oregon Association of ESDs did, the task force put together a list for us of the kinds of services and that coordinated effort that they felt was necessary to help school districts and school districts provide input, and we put all those pieces together in a bill and we say, rather than having the debate today, should we add, subtract, multiply, or divide ESDs? Let's sit down and put together a process whereby we can once and for all evaluate this system and put in place a system that makes sense. And that's how we tried to put together Senate Bill 765, so that we're not predetermining the number. In fact, on page 3, it talks about providing the order to merge or divide. This is on line 36. Merge or divide. In other words, we wanted to make it clear that we weren't saying we were suddenly going to have only 8. What we're saying is we need to look at the delivery system and identify what are those kinds of coordinated services that need to be provided to help school districts and thus help children be more successful. The No Child Left Behind law requires us to have a statewide delivery system. The Department of Education doesn't have the capacity inside the department itself to provide direct service to 198 school districts. It is our regional, it is our ESDs that are that regional system that we need to incorporate, and this was an attempt to try and get that coordination together once and for all that really made sense for the whole system. So the process calls for all the school districts and the ESDs and the communities to give input to the superintendent and the Board of Education to say, here's the design that makes sense in our region, and then craft that, come forward with that plan based on that kind of public input, and then act on those desires and that input. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sager, does it make any sense to start a process that's to sort of comprehensively review what structure ought to be of ESDs and then to carve out one category of ESDs, the frontier ESDs, from that process? Or wouldn't it make more sense to leave them as part of that process, not necessarily predetermining what the outcome will be?
Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, I would prefer, I know the governor would prefer that we have a holistic view of this process, which is why, again, we designed it this way. It does seem to run counter to say, except for. And it was kind of the other extreme than what we started off with, where we had the predetermination that we'd reduce it to 12 or whatever the original number was. I'll tell you, we have not had any success over the past several years. As Ozzie Rose indicated in his testimony, we've done studies and we've come up with ideas and they've all fallen flat. We haven't had any success. So I guess my answer is qualified in that if we can make a major step forward in this effort, that is better than no step at all. And so you understand my qualified answer.
I understand. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Sager, in regard to the comprehensive review to evaluate a process with significant public input, would you anticipate that would be a pretty involved and developed process when you're trying to bring various communities together?
Chair Boquist, Representative Flores, I do, and the work group when we discussed this did. And what we saw was that, in fact, the various options would be created, the menu of different ideas would be created, sent out through the ESDs and the school districts to really have a dialogue with the communities and the ESDs and school districts to help maybe even bring forward some of the issues that have been suppressed. And the reason I say that, a lot of the information that we got from the work group was based on we know that, you know, this school district or that ESD, we don't really want to say anything bad about them, but here's the problem we're having. And so we were trying to hold in confidence that kind of communication and deal with the underlying issues that those topics brought forward. And so we're hoping that through this dialogue, those issues can be raised, they can be dealt with, and the plans and the ideas coming back can really help us address those concerns.
Follow up. Thank you. This is July 14th, 2005, and this legislation, should it be enacted, would be supposed to be ready to go on or before March 6, 2006. And by my calculation, that's 8 months. And I'm concerned about that extensive, comprehensive input.
Chair Boquist, Representative Flores, whenever we begin this process in legislative session, we always view ourselves as having a lot more time than what when we head towards adjournment here. So you're right. It is a very tight time schedule. At the same time, I think that helps us focus our attention, that, in fact, this isn't something we can kind of put on the back shelf and say, well, we'll get to it later. With this kind of timeline, it means that the department and the superintendent has to really be focused and put out the plans, that the school districts and the ESDs really have to engage in that dialogue as soon as we get the school year back in session, because that's really when you can have the connection with the community. So it is a tight timeline. I don't think it's not doable, and I think it helps us really focus our energy on this kind of issue.
Follow up. Thank you. And you also mentioned the phrase to merge or divide. Now, if we merge, we're talking about reducing the numbers of ESDs. However, the opportunity, the door is open to divide, so we could actually increase the number of ESDs, as I understand this. Is that correct?
Chair Boquist, Representative Flores, you're absolutely correct. Because, again, we received some testimony from some areas of the state where they felt, again, looking at geographic issues, and so, that maybe our boundaries aren't correct the way they are. And so we might have to divide some current ones, merge others. What the final number would end up being would be based upon the determination of the proper shape, size, and configuration, not a predetermined increase or decrease.
Follow up. In section 5 of the bill, it talks, and sub or paren 3, it talks about outstanding bonded indebtedness of former ESDs under the auspices of the bill. They would be former ESDs, and to be distributed over the entire area of any education service district formed by a merger. Now, do we have a list, a spreadsheet on the numbers of dollars that we're talking about that would be spread over to new entities?
Chair Boquist, Representative Flores, I don't have such a list. The issue came up that if, in fact, there were mergers to take place, as when we merged school districts and other entities in the past, that we would have to have some language in place that says you would have to deal with this issue, because there may be a difference in the embodied indebtedness, and in the merger, the new area gains access to the asset that was bonded, et cetera. And so this was the language, I'm not a lawyer, this was the language that Ledge Council said we needed to make it clear that, in fact, this issue had to be dealt with if there were mergers.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony, and James, you went up in my esteem because you're not a lawyer. Representative Hunt, you want to finish this up? And just for the record, Representative Hunt's not a lawyer either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Really want to bring two perspectives to this. One, as a former school board member who was very well served, the students in our district and the staff in our district, by the particular ESD that Representative Flores, Representative McPherson, and I come from, the Clackamas ESD, which really has done a very effective job of focusing in on their mission, developing great partnerships with the districts, and having a very regular dialogue about what services are needed and not, adding services as appropriate, deleting services as appropriate. And so there clearly is a very important role to be played by ESCs. But let me, as a second perspective, let me bring the perspective that I hear regularly from constituents, that we have a public perception problem out there. And I think it's probably true across our state, where people, first, don't understand the role of ESDs, and second, are concerned that there are problems. Some of those problems have been alluded to earlier by the good representative from Heppner, but that they're not unique to that ESD. And I would really encourage you not to see this as a choice between the status quo or some kind of major comprehensive reform like was proposed in the session. I think with this bill, perhaps with some amendments have been suggested, you've got an opportunity to focus on moving this issue forward, claiming the best of ESDs, while at the same time reassuring the public that we are focusing as many dollars into the classroom and ensuring that ESDs are functioning in a cost-effective, responsible way. I guess as I look at this bill, I think Senate Bill 765 really does attempt to look at how we can reduce the gaps in services while increasing efficiencies, and I think that is where we need to be. One other thing I would close with is, as I look at the bill, the whole issue about carve-outs, I guess I would encourage you not to carve out the Clackamas ESD, even though they're doing a good job, or to carve out any other particular ESDs, but apply the consistent standard that I see that this bill applies. Just to read one section on the top of page 2 in the bill, on line 5, where it talks about the State Board of Education shall base their designation on whether the ESD has or will have sufficient capacity to deliver services, whether that capacity has been consistent, and whether the ESD has demonstrated quality in the delivery of services. Those seem like very fair, consistent standards that have merit in Clackamas, which is doing a good job, as well as in all the ESDs statewide. So I would encourage you to keep that consistent standard applied statewide, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Question is the good representative?
I have a question.
Oh, you don't get off so easy. Representative Flores.
Thank you. Representative Hunt, I agree with you that that we do have a public perception issue that is perhaps driving a lot of this discussion. If, by virtue of the language to provide the opportunity to divide ESDs, therefore to make more, we would be inserting now into this debate some additional superintendents, which increase costs, and I think probably is some of the discussion that the public perception is challenging on superintendent salaries and so on. Now, in that context, then, would you say that this is the best public policy approach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I think you may be on to a very specific issue that may be worthy of an amendment in this bill. If there's a possibility that passage of that particular, really the two words you're talking about, the or divide, would contribute to the public perception problem we've got, it may make sense to delete those two words. But I guess my concern would be that we not lose the whole bill, not lose the whole focus forward, that if there are specific problems like that, and there may be a few others, that we zero in, make amendments to those sections, and move the bill forward. Really, so we're not left with the Senate, as the chair said, having taken such a strong bipartisan vote to say we're going to at least move toward ESD reform, and then it died in the House. I don't think any of us want that on ourselves, and so I guess I would encourage you all to make amendments that are needed, but continue the bill forward.
Thank you.
Follow? Yeah. Good. Thank you, Representative Hunt. Yes. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 704, excuse me, 765, and we're going to open a public hearing, brief one, on Senate Bill 704, after which we will drop down to 1074 out of order. So at this point, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 704. And Sandy, will you bring us up to speed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 704 is requiring that the directors of the Department of Human Services or the Department of Corrections to dispense as written prescriptions for a brand name mental health drug for any person in the state institution if the prescription prescribes dispense as written or contains the notation DAW. Or other similar meanings. It declares an emergency. Is it effective on passage? And I have some testimony from
Oh, thank you. From Senator Carter's office for your reference.
John Christensen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Christensen, and I serve as Chief of Staff for Senator Margaret Carter. Senator Carter is currently on legislative business. Can you hear me, sir?
Yeah.
Thanks. I can be soft-spoken, mm-hmm. and I apologize.
Okay.
We have provided to your staff copies of Senator Carter's testimony on Senate Bill 704B. Senate Bill 704 clarifies policy with regard to medications coming into the corrections system and into state institutions. We've worked with corrections, the Department of Human Services, mental health advocates, members of the community, and industry. The bill has no or minimum fiscal impact. It has been unanimously approved by the Senate Committee on Health Policy, the Senate Budget Committee, and the full Senate. What the bill does, it clarifies policy of the state for individuals that are coming into the custody of an institution, so the individual is to receive the medication for mental health as prescribed by that individual's provider when the prescription specifies dispense as written or contains the notation DAW or words of similar meaning. Unfortunately, many of you know one out of seven individuals in our prison system right now are mentally ill. And the concern is that individuals receive the appropriate medication when they go into the institution. Thank you.
Questions or witnesses?
Well,
then you did a great job. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Arthur Tolan, Counseling and Treatment Services Administrator for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide some information in support of Senate Bill 704B. As you are aware, roughly 14% of all inmates within the Department of Corrections suffer from a significant to severe mental illness. Stabilizing these people and ensuring that there is a continuity of care is really vital for a good functioning of these individuals while in the prison system. Therefore, it is our responsibility to develop an individualized treatment plan to ensure that they are stable and continue to stay stable. Currently, when an inmate enters the Department of Corrections and has medications, a prescription for a mental health medication, it is our practice to continue that medication until a licensed, culturally competent mental health prescriber conducts a full evaluation of that individual. Only at that time, if this prescriber considers that it is warranted to change the medication, we will change that medication. The Department of Corrections supports Senator Carter's intent with this bill to ensure that incoming inmates are able to stay on their current prescribed medications until we conduct this evaluation. In summary, we, as the Department of Corrections, we are dedicated to provide a seamless, effective, and culturally competent continuum of care for persons with mental illnesses who enter our department. We request that you send Senate Bill 704 to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kerwin, my understanding that the reason you support this bill is because you're already doing what this tells you to do. Is that the bottom line here? Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 704. With a good senator here, we're going to drop down to Senate Bill 1074 because there's individuals that have to travel some distances. So we're going to open a public hearing only on Senate Bill 1074. And Bill, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1074 modifies distribution of fines collected in traffic offenses in cases. And what it does, it limits what the city of Cobourg can collect from fines and from traffic fines resulting from outside the district. where they stop people from outside the district. Chairman, members of the committee, the last session we had a bill that attempted to address this issue, and what it did, if you look at your law that's before you, in Section 2, what it basically says, half of the fine goes to the municipal court where the person is, where it's collected. The other half will go to the district, the police officer where he works, say for the city, if it happens within the district, if the traffic offense occurred within the district. If it doesn't occur within the district, then it goes to the state of Oregon. And then what happened subsequent to the last session, City of Cobourg annexed property east of I-5 and thus was able to have jurisdiction over part of I-5.
Questions of the administrator? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I wanted to go through a little bit as to why we're here today regarding Senate Bill 1074. Council has given us an overview as to part of this. Well, I also want to make certain that individuals on the committee understand that the way this bill is now set up, it's gone through multiple revisions based on my perception of the conduct of the City of Cobourg. And we've reached to a point where we have now are requiring or would only allow only 10% of their annual general fund budget to be coming from traffic fines or revenue from traffic enforcement. The reason that's here is because if you go back, as council says, in 2003, there's two bills that were passed. One was a clarification. The law has always been existing that a municipality, their court, could only hear cases that were involving matters that occurred within their city limits, with one exception. If there is a traffic citation issued to someone in an adjacent county and that municipal court was closer to the infraction than the county seat of the other county, then the officer would have the discretion to put that into that closer court. That comes from the history of Sisters, Oregon, where individuals were being cited up on the Cascades. And for simplicity, for those who lived on the east side of the Cascades, they allowed the ticket to go into Sisters. And those who lived on the west side, it came back into Marion County in most cases, trying to make convenience for those individuals. What had happened is prior to my involvement in this would have been back in 2001, 2002, I received information from state troopers, OSP troopers, that they were very concerned as to what was happening in the city of Cobourg. I'd heard stories, as most of you know, I serve as a prosecutor, have served actually as a assistant district attorney in Lane County, and there's always been this understanding or knowledge that there had been somewhat of a speed trap there. But it got to the point where state police contacted me, individual troopers, asking for my assistance based on their knowledge of me being the legislature, plus my previous history working with them in the district attorney's office. Based on that information, we started doing some more investigating and found out that this basically became a full-blown speed trap. What we've learned from that point, and I've put together a packet for you, and that packet has the is basically a set of articles and some different letters of support from individuals that are supporting the process that we're going forward on. And what we know is that in the heyday, they were bringing in somewhere between at least 48% and maybe over 50% of their general fund budget was coming from traffic citations. There is no other city that has that type of level of reliance on traffic fines, and I'll go into that a little bit in more detail in a moment. What the articles that I have in this packet, when you look at the first one, says Cobourg budget ignores proposed cap. Now, that basically just shows you where we are today as to their current budget that they put together is actually going to be relying on $360,000 coming from traffic fines. That makes up approximately 25% of their general fund budget. The reason I want to bring that to your attention is because when you go further into the packet, you'll see, I'll just go through the packet so it will make it more easier. The next story is on the back side of the Register Guard on the Cobourg budget. It's Oregonian's editorial that they ran in December of this last year regarding Cobourg speed trap.
The third piece of information is the actual letter from the Chief of Police from Tillamook Police Department. And as it states in the first paragraph, thank you, as it says, Dear Representative Przanski, thank you very much for your commitment in addressing the obvious inappropriate activities by the Coburg Police Department. In my 25 years of law enforcement in California and Oregon, I am continually disgusted by the obvious misuse of our intended functions. Any attempt to highlight and correct these activities is appreciated. And that is a letter that came from Chief Terry Wright. That letter was dated December 28th of this last year. The other pieces of information that you have is support from the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association, as well as what I guess I want to focus the committee on is the traffic citation revenues. This was a summary of a survey that the League of Cities conducted back in 2002. They had sent out to 134 cities that have police departments a survey asking them about how much money are they bringing in through this process into their general fund. 69 of the cities responded, about 51% of those cities that were sent out, and what they found is first that most of the city's citation revenue is under 5% of their total general fund, and then it makes other references, but what I think is also worth noting is that there were only 6 of those 69 cities that had somewhere between 10 to 15% of their general fund. Now this city, City of Coburg, as I mentioned in the beginning, started off at one point somewhere around half of their general fund, 50%, clearly out of whack with all the other cities that reported. They're now down close to 25%, and what they've been doing is opposing this legislation, even though they say it's not for the money, but they need the money to continue the operations that they have. And they're using it to fund the general services of the city. Now, what is important, I think, to note on this on that area is that this city is less than 1,000 population, or just at 1,000. They have attempted to provide 24-hour, 7-day coverage. No doubt, any and every city would like to have that type of coverage if they could afford it. The city sent out a survey asking city residents to rank their priorities. I-5 patrol, which is where the bulk of this money comes from, was the lowest priority. In May of this year, there's a bond levy. It failed. Public perception of law enforcement not setting their priorities is what many people have told me as a concern of what they see when they see these type of speed traps being continuously ran. It is my belief that these type of situations actually cause the public to lose confidence in the police and in law enforcement, and that is why I believe many of the law enforcement levies that we see that go before voters are voted down. And so we need to send a message that's very clear. In this case, Coburg's over-reliance on traffic revenue for their general services is out of whack. They attempted to give that message to them in 2003. Mr. Chair, what I'll tell you is that in 2003, and probably the one article that will give you an overview of exactly how bad this has gotten, is the article that the Oregonian ran in December 19th this last year. It went through, it was a lengthy review, investigative piece that Brian Denson, who is the reporter, apparently spent at least 3 months in going through their records. What he was able to show is that the public safety budget for that city climbed from $416,000 in 2000 to more than $1 million in 3 years. That they have specialized motorcycles that have been customized to hold AR-15 military rifles. That they have, and they still run a dog team, and which is very expensive. And again, you think about for the size of the city, is it something that they can actually justify in doing? The last half of 2003, after the passage of the legislation this last session, the police in Coburg cited 3,913 motorists on I-5 alone. And according to the data the Oregonian received, that averaged out to about 22 tickets a day in that six-month period. And the bail amount ranking up to a little more than $1 million. I bring that to your attention because at the time that they were sending these into their court in 2003, they had absolutely, absolutely no jurisdiction, no authority under state law to put them into their court. That is why I've come back, because to me, they basically have thumbed their nose at this legislature and basically said, we don't care what you say, we're going to just bump it up. And that's what they did. They ratcheted it up. I had a call from the mayor at that time. He wanted to know when this bill, when those bills were going to go into effect. I told him it wouldn't be till January. And then we realized what they were doing. They start doubling up their patrols and almost running it well, I can't say 24 hours a day, but a significant amount of time out on the interstate to pocket as much money as they could before they thought the law went in effect. The reality, the law that was already on the books told them that they couldn't do it, but they interpreted it differently, and they continued to do it until January of 04. So the other thing I'll mention to you is that when you think about the size of the city and the per capita of number of officers, it's the largest in, per capita in the state. Senator Menace at the time actually remarked that what they had just in full-time officers, which I believe was 7 or 8 officers for a city of 1,000, was about 3 times as many officers per capita than the city of Portland. That did not even include the reserves, which were another 8 or 9. So they had a force of close to 17 individuals working for a city of 1,000. So we know that we would like to see cities to be able to provide services at whatever level they can afford. In this particular case, they can't. I expect that you will be hearing from the city shortly as to their concerns and what they have attempted to do. If necessary, I have the copy of their letter that they've sent out. I will be more than glad to respond to that if the committee has questions at some point. At this time, I'd like to allow Trooper Swift to make his comments.
Dan, you've got to go someplace, and we've got a senator and a representative behind you, so if you can be pertinent.
I will be quick, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. First of all, I would like to state for the record as the opinion of myself, as well as the vast majority of my members, that it is bad public policy to have any governmental or political entity receiving a direct monetary benefit from the enforcement action of that entity. It is my opinion that law enforcement and the justice system should never be used or perceived as being a substitute for a direct source of revenue to fund necessary governmental operations. The reason for this is obvious. In this country, we rely upon the voluntary cooperation of the citizenry to enforce and obey our laws and make the justice system work. The citizens support, trust, and obey the rulings of the courts, regardless of personal opinion, because by and large, they believe the justice system is fair. However, when the citizenry reaches a conclusion that the government or the justice system is biased or not fair, then they will no longer support that system, and it then fails to function. The history of the United States is filled with examples of the citizenry through simple civil disobedience causing local and sometimes state governments to disintegrate because the people decided the fix was in, the system was corrupt, and they had no moral obligation to support an unjust government. And they would not support it. As a professional law enforcement officer, I know more than most people how extremely important it is the public have faith and trust in their police force and the court system. Because the minute the majority of the public loses that trust, then we have anarchy. I believe that by allowing local governments to receive direct monetary compensation from their enforcement activity, Oregon has started down a slippery slope to losing the public's trust in their justice system. Once a city council or county commission perceives their local court as a source of operational revenue rather than a source of justice, then the overriding concern becomes the financial bottom line rather than fairness. One of the other dangers inherent in such a policy is it's clearly subject to abuse, which brings us to Senate Bill 1074. I don't think there is anyone who can look at what the city of Cobourg has been doing on Interstate 5 for the past few years and not draw a reasonable conclusion they have been abusing the privilege of this state has granted to local governments. And make no mistake, what the legislature has done is to grant a privilege. Using and corrupting the majesty and authority of the criminal justice system to enhance the city coffers in one recent year to the amount of over $750,000 is nothing less than a fleecing of the motoring public and legalized robbery. It is not as though the city has not been warned. Last session, this legislature sent a very strong message that it was abusing the privilege the legislature had granted. Rather than see the error of their ways, they instead looked for and found a way to circumvent the legislature's last correction and go back to doing what they were doing. Members of this committee, this is not about public safety. This is not about officers on the street or protecting the public. This is about money. And it's also not about the state of Oregon picking on one individual city. In our Constitution, the people have the right to petition their government for a redress of grievances. Unfortunately, most of the people being cited do not vote in the city of Cobourg, so they cannot petition that government. The state of Oregon, as the state government, is ultimately responsible for the political subdivisions that exist underneath our umbrella. It is the final responsibility of the legislature to allow the public to take their redress for grievances to this body. It is therefore the responsibility of the legislature to hear this problem and deal with it accordingly. My association strongly urges the passage of Senate Bill 1074, and I would take any questions. Thank you.
Senator, are you going to be able to stay with for a few minutes? Are there any questions to Dan? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Przanski, I'm trying to get the timing and the mechanics of the bill in mind here. I see that it has a July 1, 2005 effective date as part of an emergency clause, which I assume is because it applies based on fiscal years of the municipality. And the operative language in Section 7, bottom of page 2, says that the fines may not exceed 10% of the city's general fund budget. And it requires a payover to the state treasurer of the within 120 days after completion of its general fund budget. Well, no, the work on the budget generally is prospective, it's looking ahead. I'm assuming the traffic fine measurement, though, is a retroactive. It's looking at what's been collected in the past. So I'm just a little confused about the mechanics.
Chair, let's go ahead. And Representative McPherson, what is the intent there is that we're going to limit the city to only receiving up to 10% of their general fund. Currently, the city has a budget general fund of approximately $1.2 million. And so 10% would be $120,000. And the way that it has been interpreted by LC is that at the conclusion of their annual budget expenditures, they will need to do a tabulation and then submit the money to the Secretary of State. That money is going to actually go to DPSST for training of police officers. And so basically it will go into the state system that will benefit all of the state in their training. Okay. That's the intent, is to basically have a requirement of a offset if they go above and beyond that, whatever the 10% is, in their actual receipt of revenue.
So the budget that they've set in advance for the fiscal 05-06 budget for the municipality is, say, $1.2 million. So that means 120,000 is the limit on what they can collect in traffic fines. It must be then that it's in it's after July 1 of 06 then that a measurement is made to see what was actually collected and how does it compare to that budget that was set back at the in the middle of 05 for the coming fiscal year. So the 120 days for payover, when it says 120 days after the completion of its general fund budget, I assume that must mean 120 days after the end of the fiscal year.
That's correct.
The budget. Okay.
That's correct.
That makes sense. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. If you want to stand by, thank you, Dan, for coming. Senator Morissette and Representative Krupp are going to come up to the podium. And you may want to stay put if you would, Senator, if you've got a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
In case they counter your argument here.
Hello, Floyd. Good to see you.
I'll let you two fight about seniority.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the record. I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. I've spent all of my driving life of 30 years now driving through Coburg. I know this town well. Never gotten a ticket there, by the way. From the beginning of my driving years, from 15 and 16 years old, Coburg has always had a reputation for being very fussy about driving the speed limit through their town, and I have always remembered that and have always been very careful about that. I oppose Senate Bill 1074 as it's currently written for a number of reasons. Number one, and probably the most important in my view, is it singles out one city in the state of Oregon for a particular policy issue. I think that's very bad. I think that's a bad idea to open up that Pandora's box. What little rural Oregon city, who are we going to punish next after we pass this bill? It's bad policy to single out one city in that regard. City of Coburg, by the way, has reduced its police force by almost half because they've gotten the message. Number three is from January 2004 until November of 2004, Coburg Police issued 1,035 citations on I-5. They're here. They're all notated right here. Okay? Never received a dime from any of them. Why did they do that? Because they care about the public safety. They use their resources without receiving any money from those 1,035 citations to benefit the public safety. And now you're going to pass this bill and punish them? By the way, 63.7% of those were speeding violations. Let's talk about the other ones. It isn't just a speed trap here. 73 of them were driving uninsured. 50 of them were DUIs. And if you've ever pulled dead people out of cars like I have as a firefighter from drunk drivers, that's more than a speed trap, folks. 39 of them operating without driver's privilege, right on down the line. They're all right here. They're all listed for you. You can see them, and each individual person is listed here, too. What happened after November was the annexation occurred, which they have had in the works for many years, and I know that for a matter of fact. They just didn't do that so they could get around the law that was passed in 2003. So, is keeping the public safe abusing? Now, it's not very often I get to disagree with my friend Dan Swift, who I do count as a friend and a man I love and respect, but I'm going to have to disagree with him on that issue. I don't think that's abusing anything. Pulling drunk drivers off the road, I don't think is abusing anything. Okay. By the way, if you pass this bill, Colbert's still going to be out there. You know why? Because it is in their city limits and because they have a very large motorhome manufacturer called Monaco, and I used to work in that business, so I know what they're talking about, that has shift changes. In fact, they have two motorhome manufacturers. They have Marathon Coach also. And when the shift change occurs, and I've been by there, I've seen this happen with my own eyes, there's a lineup of people waiting, stopped on the freeway to get off on the off-ramp to go to work. There's a lineup there, and you got cars blasting past them at 80 miles an hour. That's a safety issue. And I think it's appropriate that they're out there keeping the public safety. As a volunteer firefighter, I spent 12 years working on I-5. Halsey Shed Fire District covers about 13 miles of I-5. I know how dangerous that environment is, and it is. And unfortunately, we don't have the resources in this state to fund the state police at the level I think is adequate so that they can have a greater presence on I-5. And I welcome any law enforcement presence on I-5. I don't care who it is. Because when you call to report a drunk driver and there's not a state police officer available, who do you call? Who's going to respond? And that's the issue for me as a firefighter. I can tell you I want cops. I don't care who they are. I want them on I-5 to keep us safe. Now, and the last thing I would say about my major points is if you don't like getting a traffic citation, don't break the law. It's that simple. The dog team issue, let me just make a point about that. They have dog teams there, and I view that as a very good positive because they have large manufacturing facilities, motorhome manufacturing facilities full of motorhomes. And a dog can run through there and search out when they're doing a search inside there because of an alarm or a break-in. A dog can do that so much more efficiently and effectively than having one or two police officers do it. And by the way, if the direct if as my friend Dan Swift said, if he disagrees with the idea of allowing direct monetary benefit to a city for receiving traffic fines, then he shouldn't like this bill because it allows 10%. Bottom line is, Coburg is doing the right things. They've recognized that they have, I think, inappropriately relied on a heavy reliance on traffic fines, not all of which come from I-5, by the way. And they are taking steps to wean themselves off of that. I think that's appropriate. They're in the back of the room. They can share with you precisely what those things are. I just think this is a bad policy to single out one city and restrict them in this manner when I think they've proven that they are interested in the public safety. Otherwise, they wouldn't have issued 1,035 citations from January 04 to November of 04. They could have just stayed off the freeway. They care. That's why they're out there. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to leave because now I'm late for another meeting. Thank you very much.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, District Senate District 6, which includes Coburg. I appreciate Representative Krupp going before me. I usually like to have the city of Coburg going before me because that kind of limits what I will have to say.
I was going to list a number of those points. I drove by there this morning, and there were indeed people, quarter to seven, there were cars backed up off the freeway going to work at the Monaco Coach Company. There are 4,000 people, up to 4,000 people who go into Coburg every day. It is true that for years Coburg has had speed enforcement into their city, usually on the state roads, but it's been something that they traditionally have done. When this bill was carried on the floor of the Senate, I had a question to the carrier asking what the speed limit was on I-5, and when he mentioned it was 65 miles an hour, I said, what's the problem? Who can argue with getting a ticket for breaking the law? And I, Representative Krupp, mentioned that, and I feel that is a very important point. Now, I also heard last night, or maybe the night before on PBS, that the state police are putting unmarked cars on the highway to catch dangerous drivers, reckless drivers, and they don't stop people who are only 10 miles over the limit. They are looking for people who are exceeding that. That's exactly what Coburg has been doing. They do not stop people who are only 10 miles over the limit. They could, but they don't. I have a shorter list than the representative has, but they have impounded, for instance, a number of vehicles. 72 vehicles they've impounded, drug offenses, 30. One anecdotal story was a drug bust between 2 and 4 in the morning going up I-5, which is a time when I-5 is usually not covered with any patrols. I believe the state police should be fully funded. I believe it is a public safety issue. They should be funded under the Highway Transportation, the Highway Trust Fund. I've worked to change that at times. I've worked with Representative Krieger to find different ways of licensing fees and so on, but it always comes back to the Highway Trust Fund. So I support the state police. Now, incidentally, the state police raise money for the general fund, just as the Coburg police raise money for the city general fund. The state police raises it for the state general fund. I don't, you know, we're talking minutia here. I support the city of Coburg. They have worked very hard over the last year and a half to change what many people feel is egregious behavior. They have scaled way back. They will continue to patrol I-5 because it is in their city, and I think they should. I don't see a problem. So I appreciate the time to discuss this with you. The city of Coburg are here. They will also share their views, and thank you very much.
Questions of either senator? Thank you, gentlemen. We have, I think, two people from the city of Coburg, Senator Moore, Senator Devlin. Can you guys hold on for about 5-10 minutes while late? Thank you. David Landrum and John Bosley. I'm assuming you folks are from the city of Coburg. Hey, everybody's talking about you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Landrum. I am the City Recorder and Finance Director of the City of Coburg, a position I have held since April of this year. Prior to that, I was a financial analyst for a state agency here in Salem. Senate Bill 1074 seeks to limit the revenue that the City of Coburg may retain to no more than 10% general fund revenue per year. All other municipalities may continue to operate under existing law, which does not limit this source of revenue. This bill implies that Coburg is getting rich by writing traffic citations in the section of I-5 that falls within its city limits. In reality, those funds pay only a portion of the costs of operating the Coburg Municipal Court and our traffic enforcement. In the past, high estimates of fines revenue projections led to overspending in the general fund. Actual revenues from fines in 2004-2005 were less than half of the budgeted projections, $351,000 received compared to $745,000 that was projected. Deep cuts were made during the course of 2004-2005 based on actual revenues, and the balanced budget for 2005-2006 is based on realistic numbers. These cuts have allowed the city to retain 24/7 police coverage despite the rejection of a local option levy in May of this year. Although citizens rejected the levy, and every levy that was offered in Lane County at that time was also rejected, continued police protection was the number one issue with Coburg citizens based on a survey that the city conducted in spring of this year. The city has done everything possible to maintain police coverage in accordance with the opinions expressed in that survey. Coburg is providing for safety on I-5. During the period February to November of 2004, as has been discussed earlier, the city continued to maintain a presence on I-5 and issue citations despite receiving no revenues during that time from that action. In November 2004, an annexation that had been in development prior to the 2003 legislation was completed, which brought a section of I-5 into the city limits. Under current law, citations issued within city limits are heard by the Coburg Municipal Court. The fines collected by Coburg Municipal Court are distributed in accordance with applicable statutes. For fiscal year 2004-2005, Coburg Municipal Court distributed over $24,000 to Lane County and over $75,000 to the state. This $99,000 that was turned over to other agencies would constitute 8% of the current adopted budget that we are projecting for 05-06. Additional revenue is generated for other jurisdictions when citations are written outside of the city limits that must be cited into other courts. The amount of the fines is established in Oregon law. The city of Coburg does not arbitrarily establish the level of fines for infractions. As reported in the Eugene Register Guard, based on a Freedom of Information request to review citations issued and in public testimony during Senate Rules Committee, Coburg officers are only citing speeders who are traveling in excess of 80 miles an hour on a 65 mile an hour stretch of freeway. Average excess speed citations are 86 miles an hour and some are over 100 miles an hour. If these citations are issued within the city limits of Coburg, they are cited into Coburg Municipal Court. If they occur outside the city limits, they are cited into Central Lane Justice Court or other applicable court in accordance with state statutes. Many people feel that traffic enforcement on I-5 is the sole responsibility of the Oregon State Police and that the Coburg Police should not be there. Oregon State Police, county sheriffs, and local police maintain a presence on I-5 in an effort to protect travelers, residents, and people who commute on I-5 on a daily basis. Inadequate funding for the Oregon State Police has been a common theme expressed by legislators both in public hearings and in private conversations. Reducing Coburg's presence will further limit traffic safety enforcement on I-5. It has been widely reported that Coburg has the highest per capita police force in the state. The official population of Coburg is only 1,050 residents. There are currently 5 police officers. 5 officers is the minimum that the city of Coburg can have and still maintain 24/7 coverage. Coburg has unique circumstances that dictate 24/7 coverage. Proximity to the I-5 corridor in the Eugene Springfield metropolitan area, high-end manufacturing, and a daily influx of workers that expands the city to over 4,000. Given the current resources provided to the Oregon State Police, the County Sheriff's Office, and Lane County District Attorney's Office, does it make sense to force more work on those agencies by reducing Coburg's ability to provide services locally? Reducing the revenue rate retained by Coburg will not put more officers on patrol in any jurisdiction, simply reduce law enforcement efforts in and around Coburg. Senate Bill 295, which was the original bill on this subject, applied to all municipalities but was tabled in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Since it did not focus on just Coburg, there was strong opposition led by the League of Oregon Cities. Senate Bill 1074 only addresses Coburg, so the League of Oregon Cities is prohibited from lobbying against it, leaving Coburg on its own. Senate Bill 1074 is strictly an effort to punish Coburg for past and present perceptions. Coburg is and has been in full compliance with existing state laws and statutes. It is unfair to select one city in Oregon and apply standards to it that are not applied to other municipalities. If the legislature feels that current laws are not sufficient based on the revenues derived from traffic fines, they should be amended and applied equally across the state. Thank you for your time.
John. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bosley, and I'm the interim chief of police for the city of Coburg. I've worked for the city of Coburg for 6 years. I was asked to step in as the interim chief in December of 04 after the resignation of our city administrator slash police chief. So I'm not going to speak to his methods or motives prior to me stepping into the position. Since I have stepped into the position, and I agree with the good senator that there was an over-reliance on monies derived from traffic citations, not just from I-5, citywide. And in that time, when I took over the position, I cut it immediately. I mean, it was overnight to where our presence on I-5 is roughly half of what it was. There is no one out there at night. There is no traffic enforcement at night. Since taking the position, I've had to reduce the police department because of budget problems with the city. And that included laying off three full-time police officers, changing dispatch services. I've even reduced the chief's salary by $17,000 a year. Sold and liquidated police vehicles and other equipment. Employees took a 6% pay cut. They now contribute heavily to their own benefits. I've eliminated all overtime. And on top of those reductions, I further reduced the police department budget by 49%. It's been alleged that Coburg has violated the law all along. And that's referencing ORS 153036. Now, prior to Coburg making the decision of routing citations into its municipal court from violations occurring on 5 at a time when no portion of I-5 is in the city limits, the city of Coburg did discuss, and you have an email in your packet, with the legal counsel of Lane County on whether or not our interpretation would allow us to do that. His comments were that he found that the city's interpretation, that he had found in any case saying that the city was not incorrect in its interpretation. So we started doing that. We started routing citations that are occurring on our doorstep into our court. Some of those citations have been appealed to Lane County Circuit Court by the defendant. Those appeals, you also have a copy of that in your packet. To date, there has been no appeal filed to Circuit Court from Coburg Municipal Court that has been overturned based on venue. The statute, the old statute, dealt with the question of venue, not jurisdiction. This body in 2003 clarified that statute and made it clear cut. And Coburg, at that point, ceased in routing any citations through its court. However, we did maintain our presence on I-5. That's been stated earlier. On this summary sheet on your packet, you'll see this is a time when Coburg received no funds whatsoever from any enforcement on I-5. You will see Coburg Municipal Court with two citations there. Those did get through the system. We have contacted that individual, and he is being refunded all monies, and the citation has been struck. So, if this body feels that legislation is necessary to correct that margin of error, I would ask that other agencies be looked at as well. To this date, we still receive telephone calls from courts in Lane County, including Florence Municipal Court, just within the last month, because we were getting checks from these other courts, fine shares. So our court administrator called them and said, basically explained that the 2003 law to them, that they can't be doing that, and we've had to send the checks back. It's been alleged that the city of Coburg continues to this day to violate the law. I've asked for evidence of that. None has been offered. I have asked the city attorney to research the issue to see if it is occurring or has occurred. We there's no intent by any member of my department to violate the law. Our officers exercise extreme discretion. There are many warnings issued and not citations. And I'm holding a citation right here that was appealed to Lane County Circuit Court. It occurred 9:30 in the morning. That section of I-5 is congested at that time of the morning. The alleged speed was 101 miles per hour. I did bring a map so we can kind of see what section of freeway we're looking at. I've always had a problem with the designation of a speed trap. Webster's definition of a speed trap is the concealment of police or electronic devices for the purposes of ticketing motorists. Everything within the yellow is the city of Coburg, and we're talking about I-5 here going north. This is the city of Coburg. This is our industrial park, Monaco Coach, Marathon Coach. We're talking about this stretch of freeway right here. There is nowhere to hide. These officers are setting out in broad daylight in marked police vehicles and routinely getting drivers in excess of 90 miles an hour on a daily basis. It took me 6 miles to catch one at 124. So it's a safety issue for not just Coburg, but for Oregon in general. I don't want my wife or children anywhere near somebody driving 100 miles an hour. And if for some reason should they get into a crash, the last thing on my mind would be the color of the officer's uniform and what his badge says. We have made significant strides, like I said, to try to bring that reliance down. I'm looking at ways to bring it down even further, because I don't want the city to have to look at the police department in any way to try to balance its budget or to make up a shortfall somewhere, because I agree with Mr. Swift that that is not the purpose of a police agency. If you go to speedtrapexchange.com, there are 55 cities listed on that website, 55 Oregon cities, including Coburg. But this legislation affects Coburg. Why not other 54? The bill will have a significant impact on the city of Coburg, particularly the police department. You should have an impact statement with the bill. And the fines and bails that are referenced, when you hear the term $366,000, that is citywide. That is everything. We do not separate in the budget each individual item. That includes Dewey diversions. That includes probation officer pay, probation fees. That includes citations citywide, not just I-5. Now, if this bill passes, we're going to have to essentially create a position to just comply with it in terms of monitoring what comes just off I-5 at the end of the budget year, figuring out how much in excess of the 10% we are. The League of Oregon Cities did do a survey, as the good senator was stating. 51% responded. If I can recall, there's two cities in that survey that did report percentages near 15 or 16% of their general fund budget from citations. Why aren't we looking at those two? I mean, we're at 10%. We're being told we can have 10%, but they're being told they can have 16. And the dog team is supported by local community businesses. When the dog team was instituted, there was no general fund money expended on the acquisition of the dog. And traffic teams, just by their very nature, not just in Coburg, but everywhere, are self-supporting. The Lane County traffic team supports the Central Lane Justice Court. You take away Lane County's traffic team, and that Central Lane Justice Court will cease to exist. That's what traffic teams do. You have the problem paying for the problem. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them.
Gentlemen, any? Ernie Barker.
Thank you. Chief, how many officers, it says you cut the pay $17,000. How many officers do you have, and what is the chief's pay? I'm assuming it's public record.
Okay. Chair Boklist, Representative Barker. Right now we have 5 full-time police officers and 4 reserves with 2 that are inactive. the chief's salary, when I took the position and I started, I mean, because it was kind of a secret, and I finally got the actual number, for a town of Coburg size, it was ridiculous.
So what is it today?
55?
Yeah.
It was, with certificate pay, under the old budget and the old person that occupied the position, it was into the 90s.
And that's what it is today?
No, it's down into the 52, I think.
Okay. And what is an how long does it take an officer in Coburg to reach top step pay, and what do they get? And assuming they have the certificates and so on.
That was an issue that Coburg did face in the council years ago, because Coburg, like many small agencies, was being used as a stepping stone into a different agency.
Sure.
An officer will step out on their top step with their basic certificate after 4 years.
And what is that?
And that is roughly, on a yearly basis, going to be right around 45.
Okay. Thank you. And just one other thing. I went to look. There used to be a definition of speed trap in the Oregon statutes, but I couldn't see it. I don't know if they did away with it. But what the old definition was does not describe Coburg.
President McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, according to this article from the Oregonian we were given, this is from last December, I believe, it reported your predecessor's pay in 2003 as $124,232. Is that accurate?
Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson. That is accurate. $40,000 of that, from what I understand, was overtime.
I see. Okay.
And that's been eliminated.
Yeah, Mr. Landrum, and according to an article from the Register Guard that we were given, it states that the city has assumed nearly $360,000 in revenue from traffic citations, which would be, by my just rough mental calculation here, 30% of the $1.2 million general fund. For the current fiscal year, the 05-06 fiscal year, I guess I have a two-part question. One is to confirm whether that's an accurate statement, and then whether you think that is an over-reliance on traffic citation revenue.
Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, that is correct. That is all the fines. It is not just the I-5 revenue. That's why the 25% versus the 30%, if you just look at the numbers as presented in the budget. Chief and I have discussed this in depth. Yes, that is over-reliance on traffic fines. The city, due to poor decisions in the past, has completely tapped its reserves. We're on an aggressive program to repay our reserves to a fiscally prudent level. We have made the cuts that Chief alluded to. We are doing our best to be a fiscally sound, fiscally responsible city. Unfortunately, due to the over-reliance in the past, the path to get there will take us some time unless we drastically reduce current levels. We've already reduced personnel throughout the city. We are down to two people that are running public works, two people that are running City Hall. We've made essentially all the cuts we can make without significantly impacting city services at this point. It's Chief and I's discussion to continue to work to drive that percentage down over the course of time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions?
Very quick.
Representative Flores.
Chief Bosley, very quickly, speedtrafficchange.com, is that what you said?
Chair Roquist, Representative Flores, yes, it's speedtrafficchange.com.
Okay, I'm checking it. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Seeing no further questions, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SB. Quickly, Senator. Appreciate it. You have two of your esteemed colleagues who are getting gray hair in the back waiting.
I understand. One regarding singling out one city. We have precedents in this state for doing this. Jordan Valley was an example where they got out of control, and the state stepped in and took care of that issue. Regarding the fines, or such that the alleged speeds, I can tell you I still receive calls, and there's been at least one person that works in this building who stated that their speed was below what is the citing speed, but they were written up for 8 to 9 miles over what their cruise control was set at. regarding the legal opinion that the chief had brought forward. He showed that to me. It does not. It does not pertain to the statute that they were in violation. It was a second part of that provision and did not have any tie to what they were in violation of up until they took annexation of the city in January of 2004. Up until that time, anything that went in their court was illegal.
Senator, if I could, how fast was the person cited for?
Yeah, 72 is what he had set at, and he was set at 81. Uh-huh. What I've heard, and this is the part that's really frustrating, if you look at that map, only about a half a mile of the interstate is now within the city of Cobourg. They attempted to annex over 2 miles of that, so kind of a full long stretch of it. The county only gave them a half a mile, and it's basically from one overpass to the next overpass. What I've seen personally, what other members have seen, and what I've heard from individuals, there actually have been in the past, I can't say that it's happening right now today, but what they have been doing during this session, having an officer set up where it is behind a ramp. If you're familiar with the area, going northbound on I-5, as soon as you cross the McKenzie River, there's a ramp, and then it starts out in that stretch area, and there's a vegetation. And they were sitting right at underneath the overpass, the Eggy, where it was blocked, and they were popping people as they were going north and then stopping them before they even got to the city. But what they're doing is putting on the ticket at or near the milepost, which is within that jurisdiction. Instead of being one milepost 198, they've been putting 199. But when I talk to these individuals who call me out of concern, they give me the location of where they're at, and they're not in the jurisdiction. But you can't prove it because on the piece of paper that's turned in, it says that it's within the jurisdiction.
And follow up. That's okay. Thank you. Just as a comment, Jordan Valley was different in that the guy who was chief of police over there had a contract with the city to keep all revenues that he gathered off of traffic citations to run the police department. And if you got a ticket there, you paid your bail before you left town. You couldn't just leave town. And this was in the days when Portland police were making less than $10,000 a year, and he was making $100,000 a year, the chief over there. He didn't get to keep all the money. I talked to him one time. He said he had to give some to his wife, the dispatcher. But it's a different situation.
That was fine.
Thank you. Senator, you've made a couple of references to the phone calls that you've had in this regard, i.e. complaints. And can you give us an idea of the scope or the numbers of calls that you've received in this regard?
Chair Boquist and Representative Flores, it is varied in the sense of depending on the time frame of course, whenever there's news coverage, you get more. I have to take some of that with a grain of salt as to exactly when or why people might be calling. Over the last 2 to 3 years, I would say I've heard from, somewhere between 20 and 30 people that I can, in different forms, either by email or or by phone. A lot of people that are traveling through the state, that have been stopped, start doing research and getting more information about what is, the situation. In fact, people going to the state police to file complaints or raise issues, being told that, oh, you must be talking about Cobourg. And then names and references have been given to me through through that contact as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 1074 and open a public hearing on SB 1071. And Senator Devlin and Senator Morris, I know you've been very patient. And if there's someone you want to bring up with you, that's fine also, so that we can get you out of here. And Jim, if you can bring us up to speed very quickly before they testify.
Yes, sir. It creates the Oregon Virtual School District within the Department of Education. I've included in your to the SMS the Senate vote. You have the revenue statement, the fiscal statement, and has a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee. And I have two amendments that I can discuss after their testimony.
Thank you. Senators?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm here to support Senate Bill 1071. For the record, I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. The purpose of Senate Bill 1071 is to establish a virtual school district that will provide uniform access and quality instruction for all K-12 students. It will also allow the State Board of Education and the Superintendent of Public Instruction to more clearly address the challenges that have arisen when a school district has attempted to claim the ADMW for potential online students. The bill before you today is supported by the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The bill passed by a bipartisan vote in the Senate, over a two-thirds vote. Where are we now in terms of e-learning? Well, to reference past experience, Representative Flores and I attended a conference some time ago, which I think was very enlightening for me, and I believe she felt it was very beneficial. I think it really opened a lot of people's eyes that went to the conference on what the capabilities were in e-learning, what the whole gamut that you could do in terms of how much you could improve education in a state environment, both public and private. In Oregon, for K through 12, there are currently 365 public credit-bearing course offerings through online and video conference modalities. They are provided to students by 7 ESDs, 3 school districts, and 2 university K through 12 programs. Students may use any of these programs to access content not available to them in their home districts, for credit recovery purposes, for dual credit options, for accelerated learning options, to attend public school while infirm or incarcerated. Those are just a few examples. But what are the real barriers that we have now? The system we currently have has a handful of disparate locations prohibiting uniform access to all Oregon's K through 12 students. There are also no uniform accountability standards and guidelines for course development or delivery, prohibiting any type of real quality control. What would this bill do? It builds a framework for a uniform, standards-based virtual program available to all students in need of supplemental or alternative instruction options. Framework includes a fee structure that results in a self-supporting delivery system. The framework supports seamless system with common course numbering, common and uniform data, shared systems statewide. Because you'd have a shared system statewide, the outcome is a portal that provides uniform and equal access to all Oregon students. It has vertical and horizontal connections, ask for access for all students to any public educational opportunity. In summary, colleagues, a virtual school district offers an alternative learning environment that can accommodate the diverse needs of today's students, ensures quality programming and clear-cut accountability measures. I urge your support of this bill. The bill has had a great deal of public discussion. It's broadly supported in the educational community. Senator Morse is with me here today, and I believe he has an amendment to the bill, an amendment of which I am supportive. The amendment is actually quite similar to a bill that he has, Senate Bill 38, which I've been trying to get in my subcommittee for about 2 months. And so I'm very supportive of that amendment to the bill. I understand that there may be other potential amendments to the bill. I'm willing to look at other amendments, and obviously it's up to this body to determine what happens to the bill. I would just hope people would understand the broad benefit of creating a virtual school district would be for students in Oregon, the capabilities that it would have, and clearly how much it would do to make instructional opportunities far better for students than they are today. And I believe Senator Morse's bill would do a lot in terms of trying to determine our ultimate needs in terms of education and how we better can deal with issues relative to both expenditures and revenue requirements. And I apologize for the quality of my voice, and I'm on a lot of medication, so if I've slipped up on a few words here.
Well, Senator, there's a lot of people that think this committee's on medication, too. So.
May I suggest the entire chamber of both sides of this building?
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis. I, too, come in support of Senate Bill 1071 and offer an amendment for your consideration. The amendment essentially addresses the issue of fiscal reform in K through 12. As it directs, as the amendment would direct the Quality Education Commission from its current mission of determining if we want certain outcomes, what does it cost to achieve those outcomes, to determining or looking at the costs and analyzing how we are spending the monies within the K through 12 system. The amendment would includes studying the entire system, which includes districts, education service districts, Department of Education, to identify all barriers within the system that diminish resources available to the classroom. And that's really what the focus of this bill is fiscal reform that directs resources to the point of service, and that's children in the classroom, to improve education. The bill would direct the Quality Education Commission to identify all statutes and rules that create barriers to providing additional resources to the classroom, identify changes that could be made in school districts and education service districts that would result in economies of scale, including administrative functions that could be consolidated. The bill also requires the Quality Education Commission to make recommendations for providing additional resources in the classroom, to make recommendations for gaining additional resources from the elimination of barriers or the amendment or repeal of statutes or rules, and for directing or redirecting those additional resources toward, one, reducing class sizes, increasing the number of classroom teachers, making available additional classroom support materials, and increasing the number of courses offered to students. One thing that this amendment also does, it creates a joint legislative education fiscal reform interim committee, and this interim committee would be essentially one that the commission would work through and with the Department of Education in pursuing the goals of how do we get scarce resources, more resources to the point of service to children. This concept was worked in the interim. It had enjoyed support, broad support within the education community, and for whatever reasons, as we all know, some things get buried in committees and we have a hard time bringing them out. The relating clause on 1071 is adequate, and this is a concept that is, I think, merits your consideration, and would ask for your approval of the amendment as proposed.
Thank you. Questions of either senator?
Mr. Chair, I just need to be oriented to the amendments we have. We have understand the dash A5s, A6, and A7 amendments we have in front of us. Senator Morse, which set of amendments is it that your proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, it's dash 7.
Ah, okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm sorry. On the A6s, which replaces the A3 had on page 2, line 4, after public insert or private. Now it just removes public. Any other entity. Would this allow religious?
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that? That is actually not in Senator Morse's amendment. That's in another amendment that's being offered.
Okay. And you
There honestly is an attempt in this bill basically to mirror, not to expand or to delete, what the current basic requirements are for offering instruction in the state in a public school or a public charter school. So the requirements in this bill basically mirror those same requirements. The issue in terms of public and private simply is an issue over meeting the current requirements in terms of offering instruction in which you could be compensated from the state in terms of ADMW credit. It does not preclude, the current language in the bill does not preclude anyone from going outside to, for instance, a English literature teacher trying to contact someone with the Shakespearean Festival and asking them to be online for video streaming to answer questions about, Shakespearean play or what it's like to be an actor in a Shakespearean play. It doesn't preclude anyone from actually contacting a commercial fishing company and asking them if they would, be willing to appear in terms of as part of an instructional program. But it simply just means that there still has to be a teacher that is either a public school teacher or a public charter school teacher still involved in some way in that instruction. That's basically the intent of the underlying bill. I think there are several other people here, actually, that would wish to testify. I don't know if you have the time for that, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Senators. Appreciate it. Amy Grant, Roger Williams, and Laurie, hopefully someone will come up and explain the rest of the amendments. Thank you, Senators.
Thank you.
Laurie, are you the most educated on this? Okay, somebody said yes, so you can lead off then.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, again, for your record. Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 43,000 members. We are in support of 1071 as it came to you from the Senate, and we, too, agree that with Senator Devlin that the changes that were made with respect to carefully crafting the language regarding the use of public taxpayer dollars for public education is what we are comfortable with. And I notice that you have two versions of amendments that would change that careful balance, and we would be concerned about those. That would be the A3s that add or private back into the bill, and the A6s that delete the word public, which by implication from our read also do the same thing and imply that public taxpayer dollars would go to private and perhaps even religious programs. So we would oppose those two amendments. We also would like to say that we were on a work group with Senator Morris and are very supportive of adding the language of, I haven't seen the Dash 7 amendments, but I understand they are in effect the Senate Bill 38 language, and we support that as well. And the only other comment I'd make is I think you're about to hear about yet another set of proposed amendments, which are the A5 amendments. I just saw them this morning, but they appear to be the substance of a bill that has not had any success on the Senate side because a number of us have opposed taking away all accountability from the homeschoolers for making sure that the students are progressing in the homeschool environment and by removing the testing requirement, which is at a very minimal requirement. For your record, I would also like to establish that the Oregon Education Association understands that a particular kind of test that might drive a particular kind of curriculum could be a problem, and we had proposed doing some sort of alternative assessment just so that the state would have some assurance that education was taking place in the home, which it is in the vast majority of cases, and we would entertain an amendment that took a look at an alternative way of demonstrating that, but removing accountability altogether we could not support. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Go ahead, then.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name is Amy Grant, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Oregon Home Education Network, and I'd like to speak to the amendment that Senator Starr proposed, Amendment A5, I believe it is. It is different. It is derived from, but different than, House Bill 2733, which was passed by the House on a bipartisan vote, has not received a vote in the Senate. It is in the Senate Rules Committee, and it's pending. House Bill 2733 removed testing requirements as well as notification requirements. Currently, home educators, unlike other privately educated students in Oregon, have to jump through two hoops. They have to notify their ESD that they are homeschooling, and they have to take a standardized test at the end of grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. Students in private schools are not required to do this. No Child Left Behind does not require the state to do this. What this amendment would do is remove the testing requirement only. Students would still be required, or parents would still be required, to notify the ESDs that the students were going to be homeschooled. So the state would still have a procedural check to know what that student was doing, that the student was being removed from the public school and was going to be educated at home. Students in the private schools are not required to do that. I'd like to reiterate that. I think that we have a due process problem here. There's an unequal application of the laws relating to privately educated students. Home education is private education, and as I mentioned before, the No Child Left Behind Act specifically excludes its provisions for children educated privately at home. Regulation does not help education. Mandating standardized testing does not improve the education of privately educated students at home. Standardized testing is intended to rate groups of students that are receiving a particular mandated education. Home education is individualized. It is tailored to the specific student. It allows a parent to provide the education that that child needs at that time. And as any parent knows, every child is unique and every child learns at their own rate. I'm the parent of one child with a learning disability and one that doesn't have a learning disability, and I know that their needs are completely different. And I know that the assessment that I do for my children as they go along is based on that child's needs and that child's development. And if I feel that I need to bring in outside help, I do that. But mandating that my child with a learning disability take a standardized test at grade 3 is antagonistic to that child's education and antagonistic to my ability to provide education to that child. Mandatory testing is a misguided attempt to identify low-scoring students in the assumption that there is no education happening for those low-scoring students or that there's some sort of neglect going on. I can assure you that scoring low on a standardized test may reflect the child's developmental status. It may reflect the child's familiarity with filling in the bubbles. It may reflect the test. It certainly does not reflect whether there is neglect or abuse going on. I've heard a number of concerns that without standardized testing, we're going to lose children that are falling through the cracks. In Oregon, 83% of the reports of child abuse and child neglect come from sources outside of the educational institutions. And that majority of reports of child abuse and child neglect are still available, whether those children are taking standardized tests at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10 or not. And in fact, the quality of the reports that come from professional sources other than the educational institutions are higher than those that come from educators. So children are not going to fall through the cracks if they're not taking standardized tests. A statistic has been thrown out saying that 27% of home-educated students in Oregon score below average on standardized tests. Well, I'd like to point out that that's, rather than an indictment of home education, that is a very, very strong endorsement of home education. Standardized tests are designed so that 50% of the students taking them will fall below the 50th percentile. In fact, if only 27% are falling below the 50th percentile, then home-educated students in Oregon are doing twice as well as would be expected. There's been an objection that eliminating standardized testing will somehow do away with compulsory attendance in Oregon. In fact, I did a survey of states that have substantive oversight of homeschoolers, such as Oregon. Those that don't have substantive oversight of homeschoolers, such as 25 or 26 of the states. The growth of enrollment in public education as a percentage of school-age population is the same or slightly higher in the states that do not have substantive oversight of home education as in those that do have control. So in other words, there's no data to support the allegation that if we take away standardized testing of homeschoolers, our compulsory attendance laws go down the drain. In fact, the evidence, to the extent that there is any, is contrary to that. There's been an argument that if we don't have substantive oversight of homeschooling, then that somehow today truants are masquerading as homeschoolers. And if we don't have any substantive oversight, then all the truants are going to claim to be homeschooling. Well, first of all, the fact that this amendment retains the notification requirement takes one step to negate that argument. Still, parents are going to have to notify the ESD that their child is homeschooling. Secondly, I'd like to point out that over 17% of the class of 2003 did not graduate. Of those, less than 1% claimed that they were homeschooling. So if there are truants masquerading as homeschoolers, they come from a pool of 304 students out of the entire class of 2003. And I suggest that we should be focusing on the other 11,000 students from the class of 2003 that dropped out rather than 304 of them that claim to be homeschooling. I'd also like to point out that if you really want to address the problem of truancy, you will do as you already did, which was support alternatives that address the needs of the truants, such as Senator Gordley's bill. Provide options, provide opportunities for those children for whom the existing public education system doesn't work. I applaud this committee's work today to support educational options that best meet the diverse needs of children, and I ask for your support of Senator Starr's amendment. Mandatory standardized testing for individualized private education violates due process. It doesn't help the students' education, and in fact, it hurts the children that you are most trying to help. Thank you very much.
Roger. Chair Boquist and committee, you have this here. Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to
say your name for the record. With this.
Pardon me, Roger Williams, and I'm on the board of the Oregon Christian Home Education Network Association. What I'm going to just briefly explain is how the Oregon data from the Department of Education shows that the testing is not doing what the state originally intended it to do, and that it's basically a useless tool. These are the results of homeschool test scores, and the gray is what the regular population would normally score at. And you'll notice that there are few low scores among the homeschoolers and lots of high scores among the homeschoolers. And basically, if you look at that, you can see a force that's pushing those homeschool students from the low end to the high end. And if you'll notice that effect goes across the whole range of academic abilities. The boosts in achievement occur no matter what the starting level of the student. Specifically, home education is effective for students whose learning characteristics would normally put them in the lowest scoring group. There's no reason to believe that those remaining at the low end somehow missed out on the benefits of home education. They most likely just did not get enough of a boost to put them in the higher range. The primary reason given to me from people related to from the governor's office primarily, but other people related to education in Oregon is given to me for testing is to identify low scorers under the assumption that they may be educationally neglected. Test scores by their nature. And then maybe put them into the public school as a remedy. Test scores by their nature cannot indicate a student would be better off in the public school system. Likewise, they are unsuited for establishing educational neglect due to individual differences in student learning progressions. The way to deal with neglect is to follow up on the causes of neglect, dysfunctional families, drug abuse, etc. These are best identified by social services and law enforcement processes, not by test scores. The data indicate that home education is of benefit to students at all achievement levels, including the low end. So this high-stakes testing that's going on here in Oregon to identify low scores is pointless at best and causes unnecessary strains on many families, as it did in my own family in the early years with one of my children. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative McPherson, see that look.
Yeah.
I'm recognizing it quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, I'm not sure I understood your last comment. I hear the statement that testing is unnecessary for many high-achieving homeschool students, and I think the data seems to be quite persuasive that that's true across the larger population. But how do we do away with testing? How will we know whether people are performing children are performing at the level they should be. And what's the downside? Why should we do away with a testing system? You alluded to some kind of tension or something within your household created by having testing going on.
Okay, first of all, the point of this graph, at the low end here, is there's only a third of the amount of students that test in this lowest group amongst homeschoolers as we would normally expect. So something is happening in the homeschooling education process to boost even these low scores.
I know this has been a long hearing, and I want to go to the particular questions. What's the downside of testing? I mean, you're saying that we don't need it, but I hear the argument, and people can weigh that argument on its merits, but what's the downside? What harm does it do to do testing?
I'll give you the example of my son. My son in the lower grades, second, third, and fourth grade, we struggled. He has learning disability, and so he couldn't take tests well. He couldn't read well, and we struggled to keep him above the 15th percentile, which is kind of the probationary level here in Oregon. But the problem is in what we were forced to do by the law was to aim for getting him over that 15th percentile. We were forced to teach to the test in order to keep him from going into probation, and we were not able to focus on what his real long-term needs are. Well, we tried to do that anyway. Homeschooling parents, I guess our strength is that we do whatever is necessary to make sure that our child is well educated. But it was a diversion. It was hurting my son because we could not focus all of our attention on what was really necessary for his long-term education, because we had to teach to the test. Now, he was down at the 15th percentile. He is now up above the 50th percentile, which means he's above average, and that's because we were actually able to, in spite of the diversions of having to teach to the test, we were able to help him get the tools that he needed. So it was a detriment.
A follow-up, but if you didn't still have testing going on, how would you even know whether he was above the 50th percentile? Sounds like it's a success story for testing.
No, any homeschool parent knows precisely what's going on with his child without having to test. I mean, we are there daily working with. I know if my son is having problems reading. Because I read with him. My wife knows if he's having problems with math, because she's doing a math lesson every day. We don't need the test to know that. The only real purpose of the test is to tell somebody here in Salem or maybe in the school district, give them a piece of data. It's not doing the child good to be tested. Now, at least it's a mandated test. Frankly, I do tests more than the requirement for my children. But that's just as an augment. It gives me some extra data, but it's not essential for me to know what's going on. I already know.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Yeah. Berger. Hey.
No, I.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Representative Boquist,
yes.
Would it be possible for me to respond?
Briefly.
Very briefly. Representative McPherson, I appreciate your comments. My understanding of the goal, of the state's goal, is to make sure that children get an education. And I'd like to point out that if you want to help children that are at risk, then you will open doors for them rather than closing doors. And the reason I say that is mandated testing that has a punitive result, which is the parent's option to homeschool their child may be taken away if the child falls below the 15th percentile and does not then improve. That's a punitive result. If you want to help those parents and those children, you will make positive options. You will make it easier for them to get help than it is to be punished. Right now, with the standardized testing, which really doesn't identify learning disabilities, it identifies children that struggle with standardized testing. If you want, by having those high-stakes tests, you are causing families to either alter how they educate their children so that it's not necessarily addressing the children's needs, or you're causing them to not register with the state and to be non-compliant. There's probably a third of the homeschoolers in Oregon are non-compliant because they believe that mandated standardized testing harms their children. If you want to help those children, you will make services available, you will open doors, and not have the punitive nature of the standardized test.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Laurie, go ahead.
Everything that was just said about testing is also true of children in public education, and I think that we need to be very careful about what we're trying to achieve and how one measures it. And as I said in my earlier testimony, we believe that if a particular kind of test measures something other than what the homeschool parent elects to teach the child, there ought to be an alternative assessment approach. I wanted to make very clear that what we want to see in Oregon law is some minimal standards of accountability so that those rare families that are providing no education whatsoever or an ineffective education for their child be able to be diagnosed and found out. And in fact, that test has served that purpose. I can tell you in my own child's school, a child came back into the public education system for repeated inability to pass a very, very low threshold, 15% success on an exam, and had to come back into the public school system as a 9-year-old, which would have put that child at the third grade level, but the child was not even able to write her name. So, and the school was able to pick up and ameliorate and find no learning disability per se, and was able to help that child. But just so you know, there are two sides to that struggle, and if there's a better way to get that job done, we're open to hearing what that might be. But absent that, simply throwing out the proverbial baby with the bathwater would not be an approach we could support.
Thank you. Appreciate all your testimony. Joyce Padilla, you're the last one on this particular bill. We still have another half hour to go.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. My name is Joyce Padilla, and I also serve on the board for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association, but I am also a foster parent in the state of Oregon, certified with Marionville County. So I have, over the last 20 years, not only home educated, but in the last 5 years, I have also been having the privilege of being able to also home educate foster children. And these are children that are coming into the system because of child neglect and abuse, and children that bear drug alcohol effects. So there are many developmental delays due to the drugs and the alcohol that they've been exposed to and the abuse and the neglect. And I can tell you that the standardized achievement testing, the one-size-fits-all test that is mandated in the state of Oregon for home educators does not help these children at all that are in the foster system. It's very detrimental to them. These are children, because of the drug and alcohol effects, have a very slow cognitive pace. They function at a much slower thinking pace. They need more time to think. If you can think of them as they are children who are the 10-second children in a 1-second world. They can't give an immediate answer. But if you're going to monitor their educational progress, then they have to have more time. They need that time on their side. And that is what home education has done for these kids who are in foster care in my home. I can give them that individualized instruction, and I can watch them. You see their educational progress as they work at their own pace. They are moving forward. I have an example of a child who we did some testing on him, who was in foster care, who we did a timed test and then an untimed test just to see the difference it would make in him. And in the time test, in many areas, he was scoring low average or below average, and when he was allowed the untimed, or in other words, was allowed to finish the test after time was up, he went all the way up to above average to high average. And so it did make a significant difference. If you were to go only look at the time test, so you would think, well, this is a child who's really struggling. He's, you know, maybe having difficult learning. This is a child who's very bright. He just needs more time. And so I would ask you to support the Senator Starr's amendment, A5 amendment, and on the basis that standardized achievement testing is not a valid way to judge educational progress in the state of Oregon.
Questions by any members? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 1071 and open a public hearing on SB 173. Janet. And while Janet is coming, Mike Marsh and Jessica Adamson, if you'll make your way up here, we'll hear the administrator's review, and we'll move from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 173, and it's a bill that has not been amended, it's the original version that passed the Senate, creates a two-tier system for certification of an emerging small business. The two tiers are, the Tier 1 firm would employ fewer than 20 full-time employees and have an average gross receipts that not exceeding $1.5 million for a construction firm or $600,000 for a non-construction firm. And a Tier 2 firm would employ less than 30 FTE and have an average annual receipts below $3 million for a construction firm or $1 million for a non-construction firm. It also, the bill increases the limit of participation from 7 years to 12 years, and that would be 6 years, generally 6 years at each tier. Mr. Chair, the idea is to expand the pool of people that participate in construction projects and keep some of the firms in the program longer to take advantage of the benefits of the system. Mr. Chair, this is brought to you by the Department of Transportation. Department of Consumer and Business Services is also supportive of the bill. And finally, the bill does transfer the emerging small business account from the Consumer and Business Services to the State Highway Fund. The Department of Transportation has been administering the program funds, and so this is really showing what's been happening in practice. The program has not been, the amounts in the program have not, or defining the businesses have not changed since 1989 when the program was established. There is no fiscal impact, and you have one statute that's being repealed, and we have a copy of it on your, at your place. Thank you.
Any questions to the administrator before we proceed? Mr. Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. Your staff has given an excellent summary of the bill. I'll just briefly touch on a few points, and I hope you have my testimony there. Again, in 1989, the Emerging Small Business Program was established and defined, and the primary area that we're addressing today is the definition of $1 million for construction firm annual gross receipts and $300,000 for non-construction firms. Been a lot of change in terms of inflation and size of projects in Oregon since then. We'd like to see emerging small business given an opportunity to compete fairly in the marketplace, and the training they get through the Emerging Small Business Program allows for that. The changes discussed by your staff primarily move the area for construction firms from $1 million to $1.5 million of receipts and from $300,000 to $600,000 for non-construction firms. Several other changes in the bill that allow for expansion of the pool and opportunities for other firms that have grown in the last several years and currently don't meet the qualifications for the program, but under the new bill would be able to meet it, and establishes a pool of Oregon companies that can increase the capacity for more large projects, more complex projects, and to be successful not only as subcontractors but potentially as prime contractors. The bill also allows for those who graduated or got too large for the program in prior years when there were less opportunities than currently under the Oregon Transportation Investment Act to requalify during a one-year window and come back and be able to learn and compete in a better way.
the small component of the bill that deals with the account at the emerging small business account at the Department of Consumer and Business Services deals with the fact that in the shift that occurred of the certification program back 15 years ago to the Department of Consumer and Business Services included the shifting in statute of the account. That was not envisioned. It's not what's required by the Federal Highway Administration. Therefore, we right now do a transfer, interdepartmental transfer, in order to make that those funds come back to ODOT for expenditure. This is to simply clean up that component of the statute so that we're in line with federal requirements. Mr. Chair, members, this change really allows for the standards to shift to meet the needs that exist right now, allow small companies to be able to compete on a stronger basis, and complements the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, bringing into line with a legislative direction to assist small business as we do that investment act. Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're strongly in support of this bill, which is good for businesses in the construction industry of all sizes. For the smallest of the small are folks that are just starting out and trying to get their make their way in the public marketplace. This is a very useful bill. Those folks that start a business and decide to go into public contracting, they have no idea that on top of all of the requirements of just owning and operating a business, the requirements that they have to face and to compete in the public marketplace are significant. And these kinds of programs enable those firms to get some assistance in operating their business, some sheltered market opportunities where they have the opportunity to compete essentially amongst themselves without some of the bigger folks coming in and kind of encroaching on that, so they have a chance to do smaller projects and develop the skills to be good subcontractors, which we need as larger general contractors, as well as really grow in their business environment and savvy with some real assistance from the department. This bill is helpful for generals because as we do federalized work, there are requirements to use emerging small businesses and all of the categories of folks that fall under these designations. Finding qualified firms that meet these designations is challenging. The folks that are really good are very, very busy, and they grow very, very fast, and they grow themselves out of this program, and then we start over. By enabling these firms to stay in this program for a longer time, first of all, they'll get themselves established a little bit better. Second, they'll be available as subs better, because the problem when they find themselves out of the program, their ability to get a bid becomes much more difficult. And if they aren't of a certain size, their ability to compete in the market becomes much more difficult. So by enabling them to essentially step their way out of the program and step their way into the broader marketplace, we're making it easier for general contractors to comply with federal requirements, and easier for these folks, once they're out of the program, to compete on their own and stay profitable and active in the industry, which is to everyone's benefit. It really is a win-win situation, and we just really encourage this committee to hopefully schedule a work session on this bill soon and move it to the floor. It's a great bill and will be very helpful. Thank you.
Questions of Jessica or Mike? Thank you. We appreciate it.
Appreciate
thank you
for your testimony. Time.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 173 and finally move to a public hearing on SB 358. Janet, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 358A creates the Oregon Quality Jobs Task Force to coordinate and assist in the development and evaluation of at least two demonstration projects involving natural resource management and restoration. The charge to the task force is to improve cost efficiency of natural resource restoration work while meeting quality employment goals, perhaps, and to look at ways to do alternative contracting, perhaps bundling interagency contracts, and to look at alternative funding methods. Mr. Chair, agencies that have authority over natural resource management and restoration activities are asked to assist the task force, but the funding will come from the Department of Economic and Community Development. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee, and you should have a fiscal impact here.
place.
Any question of Janet before we proceed? Gentlemen, you can, one of you can lead.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and committee. I appreciate taking the time to hear this bill. For the record, I'm Bill Cluthing, Western Council of Industrial Workers here in Oregon. I want to thank you for taking time to consider Senate Bill 358, what we've been calling quality jobs. Senate Bill 358 is small, but we feel an important bill, and yes, it does have a small fiscal impact. This bill creates a board that will work with the natural resource agencies that will create the workforce. What we see as a result of this passage of this bill is a number of small work groups established in rural areas where the various resource agencies have the responsibilities for caring for Oregon's natural resources. With these agencies working together and bundling contracts, these groups would have almost year-round work, family wage jobs, with family health insurance and other benefits. Further funding for these groups would also come from grants from the Oregon Water Enhancement Board. I offer an example of the Coquille Watershed Group who gave testimony earlier this spring on the Senate side. They have now for a decade maintained a crew from 8 to 11 people full-time year-round, family-wage jobs, working from their homes and doing the work that these new work crews would be doing throughout the state. This is what Senate Bill 358 is all about, creating high-skilled work crews throughout the state, near their homes and communities, in Oregon's natural resources to benefit all Oregon citizens now and in the future. This board will report back to you next session on the results, and we feel they will be positive results, when the function of this board and the board itself will cease after that report in 2007. I'll try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us at this late moment in the day here. My name is Ed Glad. I am also with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. And Representative Boquist, you're the only one on the panel that didn't get a chance to vote on this in the last session. We passed this out at the very last hours of the session, and the Senate had already adjourned, so we didn't get a chance to see it all the way through. And it's been revised a little bit. It's been scaled down. In the last session, we had five demonstration projects, and it was actually in a board. This particular Senate Bill 358, the engrossed version, has changed it from a board to a task force. And the task force will dissolve at the end of the project of the two demonstration projects, which enhance the ability of the bill to move forward to this point and hopefully beyond. We have been representing workers in the wood products industry for 125 years here in the Pacific Northwest, and we have been greatly concerned for the last 15 or 20 years because of the reductions of the amount of timber that's being taken from our forests and processed. The mill workers, the fellers, the industry itself has been wrecked, and yet there are still generations of families that are looking for the opportunity to continue to live in their small communities. And this is an exploration of a concept that that really says if there is a new value that has emerged in restoration work, then why wouldn't we work with all of the agencies, as you passed all the different budgets for the various agencies that have included an element or a piece of restoration work, why wouldn't we as a state and as a policy explore the ability for those various agencies that do restoration work to bundle those contracts together to give opportunities for these small communities to employ people that are doing the restoration work. So that's what we're here for, and certainly would like to see this bill move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Questions? We're speechless. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 358. I believe we concluded our business of the day, and 1 o'clock tomorrow, is that what we're posted for? 1 o'clock tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned for the day.